Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of The Rick Emerson Show is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
Mr. Yuck is me. Mr. Yuck is green.
Home is full of lots of things that children shouldn't touch. Home is full of bad things that can hurt you very much. Now there's a man whose face is green that you ought to get to know. He'll warn you when danger's coming fast or slow. Get to know his face in every single place. When you see it, you'll know quick. Things marked yuck make you sick. Sick, sick, sick. Sick, sick, sick. Mr. Yuck is me. Mr. Yuck is green.
They call me Yuck Mouth, 'cause I don't brush. Oh, I like my teeth like this. They call me Yuck Mouth. No, I won't brush. How's about a little kiss? I got those beef in my teeth. Got some chicken too. Ouch! That's a cavity. Hey, that's new. Well, if you don't brush your teeth, then kids, you too can be a yuck mouth.
Don't be a yuck mouth. Another nutritional message from the ABC Television Network.
Why, hello, it is 27 minutes after the hour of 1-1-1 in this, the month of January, the year of our Lord, 2011. Thank you for coming by, making a part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of this, the Emerson News Network. Thank you for joining us. It is Thursday, and welcome to day 12. If you'd like to be a part of today's program, why wouldn't you? Why, I ask? There is no earthly reason. It escapes me. It's inconceivable. It's incomprehensible to me that you would not want to participate to some degree in this cavalcade of fun and whimsicality. Isn't that right, Don?
Maybe you're deaf and you can't listen.
Can I just tell you this? At one point... never mind. I don't even remember what the joke was at this point. But years ago, when I was a young and obnoxious DJ, I was making some joke. I made some joke about deaf people, or I was making I was doing something stupid. I was telling a Helen Keller joke or something, you know, whatever it was I thought passed for wit when I was like 19. And I swear to God, at one point, the general manager came into the studio during the morning show, and he sternly lectured me that I was not to engage in that sort of humor on the air because, and I swear to you, he said this.
Oh, God.
Because he did not want to alienate deaf listeners or advertisers to the show. And then we just sort of looked at each other for a long, like, Arrested Development second. And then he just sort of turned and walked out. And that was the last I ever heard of it. It's the Rick Emerson. It's a true story. It's a Rick Emerson radio program. It's 503-505-6964. Thank you for joining us. 503-505-6964 with your comments, questions, clarifications, observations, ruminations, ponderings, musings of an ironic nature, whatever it is you might have. You can also email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. That is rick@rickemerson.com. Don Taylor can be emailed at, if that's your pleasure. It's Don, D-A-W-N, at rickemerson.com. Text box is open on the website, and you can also Skype if you like. It is Rick Emerson Show. That is our Skype username. That is Rick Emerson Show via Skype. Coming up today, we got your Clown Watch. And this isn't a repeat. This isn't an encore, not a rerun. I mean, if you're listening live, it's not. If you are, then... You know, then it's not. If you're listening later, then I guess it is. But that's like a philosophical problem you have to suss out yourself. The thing is, it's Thursday, January 20th, and this is like the 19th day in a row. Day 19 of Clown Uprising. America under siege. It continues. So we got a Clown Watch coming up today. Also, a Taser Watch. And we'll do a top five. Actually, yesterday's top five which we did not get to. We went, and I think actually yesterday, if I recall the chain of events correctly, I think it was the clown that actually pushed us over time yesterday. Did we have some whole clown discussion that led into a giant fetish talk about something or other?
Unsurprisingly, yes.
Anyway, so we never really had time for the top five. So we will do yesterday's top five today. And that is the top five classic bubblegum songs of all time. We'll do that because of the passing of Mr. Don Kirshner, A&R man extraordinaire, low the past few decades in American life. So that is the top five classic bubblegum songs of all time. Also, Anna Griffin from The Oregonian is going to be here. And we'll do clue number three. We will do question number three. I keep saying clue, but we'll do question number three for the EH Vending Contest. EH Vending, one of the proud sponsors and business partners making this program possible. EHVending.com is where you can find out more about them. That is EHVending.com. More on that here in just a bit. Don Taylor is tracking the following headlines for you on this Thursday.
Snow and ice close a park in Hawaii. The Air Force sentences a swinger for exposing his partners to HIV. And a TV newsman is hospitalized after fighting with his producer.
I have a question for you. Did we ever determine the gender of the Frito Bandito?
No, I mean, it's always assumed that he's male, but I mean, you assume that about
because
things
he's a
like
criminal?
The Trix Bunny and Ronald McDonald. I mean, we don't know for a fact that they're not. We just accept it on faith.
Now, wait a minute. Now, the Trix Bunny, though. Isn't the Trix Bunny referred to at one point as being a he? Well, he's voiced by a man, and I guess the Frito Bandito is too.
Yeah.
Although it could be part of some elaborately constructed disguise.
That's true. It could be they could all be cross-dressers.
It seems that the Frito Bandito is one of those things that ought to be making some sort of an ironic comeback. You know what I mean? Or maybe that, like, you know, like a certain section of the youth would be taking it back. They'd be embracing it.
Yeah.
Trying to subvert the dominant paradigm.
Did you have Sambo's restaurants
yes,
here?
Yes, we did. Well, when you mean here, you mean in Portland or just in the Northwest?
No, in the Northwest.
Yes, it was one of my hometown, unsurprisingly.
Because I remember I enjoyed the Sambo's restaurants very much when I was a child. And for those of you young folk who don't recall, there was a story, a children's story, called Little Black Sambo that was like it was about a little black boy. I don't know if he was, I believe he was African.
He was actually.
Because there were tigers.
In the original telling of the story, strangely enough, he was actually Indian.
Yeah.
But then at some point, the story transmogrified. There was then, but it's like a lot of those stories, where it just, you know, from one culture and one area and one country to another gets passed around. So the version that gained widespread currency, I think, in sort of mainstream awareness, took place in Africa. So he started as an Indian child, then he became a black child at one point.
And the story somehow involved tigers trying to eat him and him running around in circles and the tigers chasing him around in circles until, for some reason, the tigers turned into butter.
They actually, the tigers were actually, he was actually so fleet of foot that the tigers were chasing around in a circle and the tigers... And they never really go, this is sort of like a step three question mark and then profit sort of a thing. They never really give you, there's like a great whack of the film strip missing somewhere because the tigers are chasing him and the next thing you know, la-da-da-da, butter.
Yeah.
And they whip themselves into a froth of butter.
So they had there were these awesome coffee shops that were kind of a cross between Denny's and IHOP called Sambo's. And they had these elaborate like mosaic murals.
Well, they were sort of, there was almost like a pictograph. Design on the inside of the restaurant where they would show you the story in action, like one panel at a time, like a comic strip of some kind.
And one of their specialties were pancakes, and they came with tiger butter.
I don't remember that, really.
Yeah, and I loved Sambo's. And then there was this point in like...
This is one of those things that they're going to excerpt, and somebody is going to start a Sambo's restaurant, and you are going to be used as the poll quote.
I love Sambo's, Don Taylor.
And right, but the thing is, it'll say Don Taylor, and then below it'll say Rick Emerson Show in huge letters.
And then in the late 60s, early 70s, it was deemed that the Little Black Sambo story was racist. And Sambo itself had become a term.
Yeah, I don't think it was the story was racist.
No.
I think the term had become...
The word Sambo had become a derogatory term for black people.
We are setting a land speed record today for usage of the term Sambo, by the way.
So then the restaurants all closed in disgrace. And as a child, I was deeply disappointed by this because...
Did you lament it? Did you complain about it loudly? Mommy!
It was explained to me.
Mommy, why can't I go to Sambo?
I understood. I did understand.
The struggle of the black man.
But when you're a kid, there are certain restaurants like Bob's Big Boy that are just so wonderful as a child because they just have, for some reason, something you want and a cartoon aspect. Like Bob's Big Boy, they gave you comic books just for the kids with Bob's Big Boy having adventures. You could read your comic book.
I only barely remember that. Now, I don't know. Maybe that was a thing that they got rid of at some point when I was growing up, if they discontinued the comic book at Bob's Big Boy. I remember at Bob's Big Boy. That was did they have the huge?
They had the comics at least into the 80s because I remember going in the 80s with friends.
When you would go to that restaurant, did they have the huge like polyurethane statue out front of Bob's Big Boy holding the platter of hamburgers? And he had the huge cowlick Ronald Reagan haircut.
Yes. And you could get. I had for years. I don't know what happened to it. Sadly, I had a plastic Bob's Big Boy bank. So it was just a bank of him standing there thinking, and he had a slot in the back of his head, and you could put money in him.
We had that. My grandmother had the Bob's Big Boy bank. I remember when I would go there that they had done a thing. Maybe this is as they were transitioning away from comics. They had moved to the table that was covered not with a tablecloth but with white paper, and they would give you a fistful of crayons, and then you could actually just be coloring and drawing on the table itself. By the way, we've already got like 9 comments, and I'm not even going to lie. All of them from our good friend Keelan. Started off a few minutes ago by saying, I don't think I would call any place named Sambo's awesome, but maybe that's just me. maybe that's just me being both figurative and a little literal at this point. And then he's asking if instead of, this is again our friend Keelan, I'm merely a messenger for this. I'm a conduit for this. I don't even want to say this out loud. I was imitating you as a small child saying, you know, Mommy, why did they close the Sambo's? He has now typed out phonetically the query. Did it sound more like, he's now taunting me for not saying it. He's typed out phonetically the query. Did it sound more like, Mommy, why did they close the Sambo's?
Oh, Mommy, I miss the Sambo's, Mommy.
Okay.
I will say, as a child, you don't know racism. They had huge stacks of pancakes and murals with a little kid being chased by tigers.
That's and I'm with you on that. That is all I knew when I was a kid, and I am probably the last generation that can remember that, because I think Sarah and I had this discussion at one point because there was a Sambo's restaurant at the coast here, I think in Lincoln City, and it was the last one in this part of the country. Because I think that they must have kind of gone away everywhere else. I mean, I assume that there were some in the South, just because that's what you figure. But I mean, I don't think you're ready like in the East Coast or anything. But I think there were some in the Midwest and there were some here. But they sort of gradually closed as the 70s and the 80s drew to an end. But there was one in Lincoln City, and at one point, and they were never able to figure out whether it was an accident or whether it was intentional, but it burned down. And there had been a lot of debate about it, because the guy... And it's that thing where, and it's like, this is the case with a lot of things like this, where there's, and everybody knows what I'm talking about here. It's one of those, it's like, Don, Sambo's restaurant is like the foot massage speech from Pulp Fiction. It is one of those things where, pardon me, it is one of those things where is it Vincent? Is that Travolta's character in Pulp Fiction?
Yeah.
Vince. He's talking about foot rubs, and he says, you know, there's something about a foot rub where you don't say it, you know, nobody says it out loud, but you all know it's there. You know there's a subtext, even though you don't really talk about it. And we've all heard this with a lot of people who sort of dig in their heels about something that sort of just seems offensive or off-putting to everybody. And it's usually like some jackass putting a Confederate flag in front of his house or something. And in this case, it was a guy running a Sambo's restaurant on the Oregon coast. And they would put him on camera about it, and he would say, I mean, accurately, to be fair, he would say, well, you know, in fact, the story of Sambo doesn't come from Africa. It comes from India. And it's, in fact, like an Aesop's fable about a small child and about overcoming adversity by being dedicated and fleet of foot and being able to outrun the tigers until your problems or the tigers are negated. They are turned into they're turned into butter. So it's about really overcoming adversity. And you could see the guy saying this, and just the look in his eye, you knew that he knew that what he was saying was technically true, but you also knew that he knew that it was just a way to jack people up, that it was just a way to be a dick about it while having some sort of plausible deniability. And he was, let's just be honest, he was just a jackass who was asking for it. And so somebody gave it to him at some point, and they burned his restaurant down. And then there was a whole discussion about whether they were going to, the insurance company, I think, if I remember this correctly, didn't want to give him the money. The insurance company's like, you know, we don't, like Allstate or whoever, said, like, we don't want to be the insurance company that rebuilt Little Black Sambo's. And you can sort of understand why that might not go over too well with their, you know, with their shareholders and their board of directors. But I'm old enough to remember that restaurant existing, and of course I would get taken there all the time by my family, and it's not like certain segments of my family were not all that enlightened in terms of race relations. But as a kid, it's like, I didn't have any idea. I just went and I was like, hey, there's a big-ass tiger on the wall, and he's got huge teeth, and and then it's like, you know, they're chasing a kid around, and then the tigers are turning to butter. Oh, my God, there's blueberry pancakes. And it was just the best thing on earth.
Yeah.
I have no way to end this story.
I don't know. I remember my mother. And
why were we talking about this?
There was something about race.
Oh, the Frito Bandito.
Yeah, the Frito Bandito.
Yeah.
There we go. So I have something to show you.
Yes.
We were talking about this earlier. Oh, do you want me to talk about what the news is first before we
Did you talk
start?
About your headlines?
No, I didn't.
All right.
Oh, yeah, I did. I already did that, so never mind.
Oh, it's going to be a great day.
Yeah.
I can just tell.
Okay. So I was, I asked Patrick, we had talked earlier, like yesterday, the day before, about big hair growing out and how Patrick, I was explaining how Patrick's hair would just grow up, like grow really big.
It became real bushy.
Bushy. And so I asked him, I said, do you know where that, he has an ID card from when he was in his mid-20s, and he worked at this place called Van Alco, which was an aluminum foundry in Vancouver.
Well, that sounds like a cheery place.
Oh, it was. He describes it as just a horrible, horrible, horrible job. He worked in, like, the smelting room or something, and he'd work there in the dead of winter, and so it would be, like, 25 degrees outside, but, of course, they had to keep the big doors open because it was so hot in the foundry.
Right.
So it'd be 120 degrees by the smelter, and then you'd have to, like, walk out to the loading dock where it was 25. Then you have to walk back to the 150 degree smelter. He was miserable.
It's like working in a Springsteen song.
But yeah, so I found his ID card, which I will show you here. But also, I posted a before and after. So you can see my husband 20 years ago and today. And it's up at Rick Emerson. Yeah.
That looks like he's wearing a wig. It doesn't even look like it could be real hair.
No. And if you actually put your thumbs like about chin level, because he didn't have the length when I met him.
Uh-huh.
But about chin level, you can see why one of his favorite anecdotes is how we met, and he immediately made some self-deprecating remark about his hair because he realized he had met a lady and was trying to make a good impression, and he said something about, I really need a haircut. And I said, in my inimitable flirty fashion, I said, oh, no, that Willie Ames thing is really working for you.
And what is it with these glasses he's wearing?
Yeah, he had the horrible, giant, oversized aviator frames, and he still had that style of glasses when I met him.
And that would have been what year?
That was 1998.
Oh, wow.
When I met
That's
him.
That's awesome.
And so I've never really been one of those women that I feel like I have to make over a guy.
Change your man.
But when I met, he had the Willie Ames hair and those glasses, and I literally was not sure he was good looking. Someone else had to tell me.
You had to get a third-party verification?
I knew I really liked him, and we were really hitting it off, but somebody else said, I had a date, actually, and was supposed to, like, leave. So I was going, well, I have to go. I can't stay and talk to you anymore, cute boy. And a friend of mine was saying, blow up the other guy. He's really cute. And I said, is he?
Is he really?
Because I couldn't really tell.
Yeah.
And then later
I
was like,
I can see that.
Yeah, no, I can see that. He is good looking. And so when we actually were in a relationship, that was when I said, okay, honey, those glasses got to go.
Okay, so what year? Okay, so you met him in 1998. What year was this photo ID from?
This is 90. He was
really?
Yeah, this is 1990. He was in his
How old would he have been right here? So he was mid-20s?
Mid-20s.
Okay, see, so it's not like I looked all that great in 1990. I mean, let's be honest about that. Well, you saw the bigger the Jesus picture.
Well, that's what inspired it. I saw that high school picture from when you were in the Kiss makeup, and you had the big long thick hair.
Yeah.
And so I said, oh, I got to show you this picture of Patrick.
And I mean, so that would have been like the late 80s or something. But I mean, by the same token, it's like I was only like 15 or whatever. Yeah. Like by the time you're in your mid-20s, you figure if nothing else, just by dint. By the way, if you want to see these photos of Patrick, they're at rickemerson.com/pictures, and they're visual aids for January 20th. That is rickemerson.com/pictures, visual aids for January 20th.
And then with a picture of what he looks like now, kind of on the thin side when he was in the hospital.
But distinguished,
but still,
older,
yeah.
Presentable,
yeah.
Respectable looking, a handsome man.
A nice looking guy.
The thing is, I'm looking, it's not so much that it's 1990, and so by then we all ought to have known better about the hair and the aviator glasses. Not even aviator sunglasses, just like regular reading spectacles that he's wearing.
Yeah, just the slightly tinted.
Awesome.
The slightly tinted, I think, if he had to go outside, giant aviator glasses.
It's that he's in his mid-20s, and you think by then he's probably been dating enough that, like, just like evolutionary progress would have dictated that he would have figured out at some point to cut the hair and to put something else on his face.
You'd think. But no, mostly I think he was just working and drinking and having crushes on lesbians. So I don't think he was really having a lot of relationships.
You're saying that's not really a roadmap to fashion progress?
No, not really.
Okay. Okay. It's good to laugh.
Yeah.
By the way, can I just tell you? And now I got to dig it up so we can put it up for comparison. Because you've got, on the left, a picture of Patrick as he was then. On the right, a picture of Patrick as he is now. I'm going to add a third photograph to this, and I got to find it, though. I have a... I won't mention the name of the band because I don't want to give it all away. But there's a band who I have one of their records on vinyl, and it's a band I think from the Northwest, and it's a heavy metal album that came out in around 1983, 1984. But I got to tell you, Patrick is like a dead effing ringer for the lead singer of this band, who improbably. Don't we all know at this point that if you're in a hard rock band or a metal band, the glasses have got to go. You can't.
Yeah.
It's impossible unless you're that Chester Bennington guy from Linkin Park. It's impossible to wear glasses and rock convincingly.
Well,
that's a thing that can't be done.
For one thing, you'd think that they'd get sweaty and they'd slip around on your face.
You're such a mom. Aren't your glasses going to smear? Your lenses are all fogged.
No, I'm thinking it would be awkward because you'd want to be concentrating on the rocking. And it would be distracting that your glasses would be in danger of possibly falling off your face.
You'd want to be banging your head. You don't want your spectacles to fly into the front row.
Right. You'd have to wear the kind that the basketball players wear with the strap.
The Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Yeah.
You're strapping them on.
Yeah, and then that's not rocking.
No, because then it looks like you're going to go swimming at the YMCA.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. I'm sorry. I'm going to be heading to the racquetball court here in just a few. Do you mind if we knock out a few jams first, you guys? I had a dream last night where I was playing racquetball. What the hell? That's a thing that just I forgot about until just now when I mentioned racquetball and it all has come flooding back to me. Why would I have dreamt that I was playing racquetball? What is up with that?
I don't know.
Not only was I playing racquetball, I dreamt that I was playing racquetball with Evan Handler. Evan Handler, he played Charlie Runkle in Californication.
Oh, I know who he is.
He was on Sex and the City, too, I think. Why was I playing racquetball with Evan Handler? What is up with that? What's going on in your brain, Rick Emerson?
Oh, by the way, here's the side-by-side comparison I did while Patrick was in the hospital after his mother pointed out that she thought he looked like Jeff Bridges.
No.
I don't think he looks like Jeff Bridges, but I can understand why she might make that comparison.
No offense, Patrick, but you know what you look like in this photograph? If you look at Patrick on the left there, you know what he looks like? He looks like... If you've seen the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, he looks like the hitchhiker, as he would probably appear now. That guy who's, like, running by the side of the road who's all spindly and is like, they used to kill animals with the sledge, but now they use the air hammer. And then he, like, cuts his hand and, like, runs out and smears his blood on the side of the van.
Oh, that's
so Patrick precious. Looks like that guy now. Well, and I've seen, actually, recent photos of that actor, and he's not a bad-looking man. So I'm just saying, it's not so much an insult. All right. Well, I gotta minimize this picture, Patrick, because it's weirding me out a little bit. All right.
If I can find it, there's another picture laying around somewhere that I think his sister took, where he was sitting around in his apartment that he shared with another guy, and he's lounging in a chair, really thin and gangly in his 20s with giant hair like that and the glasses. I think he's eating something just with like a knife in one hand.
Nachos from 7-Eleven.
And the apartment is just filthy. It's just a sty. And he's lounging shirtless in this chair and then just giving her the finger for taking his picture. And it's like, wow, you were dreamy when you were 21, weren't you?
I think probably 80% of the photographs taken of me at some point in my life had me giving the finger to the camera for no reason. Just because like you saw James Hetfield do it once and you thought it was awesome. You thought it made you look like a badass. And that didn't really... There's some photographs of me that are just freaking wonderful because I was dressed head to toe like in just like free radio station apparel or swag or like things that we were going to be giving out to listeners at a shopping mall event, and I would snag a pair of those Coors Light sunglasses for myself. And so they would be... There's this one photograph of me, and lounging is really the word for it. I am... It's not even that, though. I'm... There's this photograph of me that Lara actually has. If you ever, I don't think you've come over to the house for like one of her game nights because she's only done like two of them. And then I think she felt self-conscious about the basement. So she was finishing the remodel before she continued that. But at some point when you come over to play like, you know, poker or Settlers of Catan or something, you over the house, you're going to see in the basement, there's a framed photograph of me that is down. She has a little dressing area downstairs where she gets ready to face the day. And of all of the pictures of me, I mean, you know, we've been together for a long time. So she has a lot of pictures. She could have picked anything of me. But the photograph of me that she has framed, that she sees in the morning, like, first thing as she is picking out her wardrobe for the day, it is a picture of me when I am 15. It's framed, and she's like, put it, so it's just so between her two closets of clothes. It is a picture of me when I am 15. I am laying, and the only way I can describe it is, I am laying like Judd Nelson on the cover of the Breakfast Club VHS box, where he's sort of like, he's like laying across and like up, I'm leaning up on my fist and like on my chin, you know, and so you know, I think trying to look sort of relaxed but like a badass at the same time. I am laying in the back of of this radio station van for the station that I worked at when I was 15, and it was the OK 95 video van. And it was a thing that you would take around to, I don't know, sock hops or some such. And it was just had a huge, huge sound system in it. And then there's like a sort of like a crude early version of a big screen TV in the back. And the deal is, I guess you were just supposed to do these guerrilla raids where you would stop by like a high school and then just rock for a few minutes so they could see like how the station was taking it on the road and bringing you know, music to the people. And then you would like give out stickers or something and then you would go back to the station. And so it was me sort of like sitting in the back trying to look all hard, trying to look all tough. And I'm wearing acid wash jeans, of course. I think Chuck's. I have a really ill-fitting AC/DC shirt in which Angus Young has been speared through the sternum with a guitar and blood is spraying everywhere. And then I have these sunglasses on. They're these big black rubberized sunglasses with the silver reflective lenses, so I look like Mephisto the Fly. And then they've got, and then the earpieces are bright, bright pink. Mm. And they do, in fact, say Bacardi on the side, because we gave those out that summer as part of like, we would just have these like cheap ass like plastic bags of like of crappy prizes. We would do. You listen to the radio? Well, would you maybe someday? Would you here have a bag of stuff? And it was like a bag of like, it was like a squeezy water bottle and a pair of the Bacardi sunglasses and like a bag of Mother's cookies, and like there and like a sticker that said OK 95. Going ballistic, misspelled. And that was it. And so that's the photograph that she sees every morning to remind her, that is the man I chose to marry.
I have a picture of that I was looking for when I was digging through the office the other night, and I can't find the file that has my old photos in it, but I'll bring it in when I find it. I had some headshots done when I was 19, I think, and I was going to be an actress. And I of course had the short wedgie haircut, and I'm looking into the camera and I look very like serious and sincere. And the only thing that really gives away what year it is I'm wearing these enormous Lucite earrings.
Yeah.
And kind of going, oh yeah, the 80s were a great time for giant Lucite earrings, weren't they?
It's so weird when you look back at yourself and you realize it is just like
I loved those earrings.
Yeah. And it's like, you wonder, like, you like to think that it's not just peer pressure, right? Like, you would like to think that you have enough, you have a core of belief inside you that keeps you from liking or disliking something just because the herd says to like it or dislike it. So I don't know that it's peer pressure as such, but I think just at a certain point you just realize that who you are and who your clothing, you know, says you are not, they're no longer the same thing. You have just reached a point where the real you and then the you that you are presenting via your wardrobe, they are no longer in sync. If you look at any photograph of me from, I would say, the age of 16 until the age of, I don't know, 25, any photograph of me, if I knew I was being photographed, if it was like for publicity or for a radio station or whatever, every single, it was like I was constitutionally incapable of being photographed without hooking my thumbs in like in my jean pockets or like in my belt loops or whatever. You know, like I was an Easy Rider or something, or like I was going to go play the Forum, you know.
I was obsessed with earrings. I had like this massive collection of earrings, and I would often wear like mismatched earrings, like one stud and then one dangly one, because, you know.
Because you were.
I was edgy.
You made your own rules.
And when we were moving, I was digging stuff out of the back of the closet, and it was interesting for Patrick to get to watch this archaeological dig of my old fashion choices, where I'm like, oh, I love these, and he's like, what the hell is that? And I'm like, they're dangly earrings made out of hammered Mexican beer caps. Aren't they awesome?
You know? Wow. Awesome. Oh my God. All right. We should, at some point, we should have to bring in, we should each have, you and I should each have to bring in like one of the, like a terrible, terrible photo. Because one of the things that we have done for years on the show is sort of comparing bad air checks. You will be spared that though, because I think you had some stuff from KBOO and maybe some things from earlier, but I don't really know that you have bad air checks to share the way that I do.
No.
So we have to find a different avenue of humiliation.
Let's not do the photos though, because if you want to do bad photos, first of all, I don't take a good photo most of the time anyway. And then believe me, there people, now that everybody is on Facebook, now it's like every couple of months I have to be subjected to some horrible, puffy, nasty looking picture of me from the Renaissance Fair when I was like drunk and in a costume.
Hey, what is the photograph that's on your Facebook profile now?
Is that the one with me with the bat?
No, it's somebody drinking.
I think it was Robert Wagner, someone posted.
Is it like Parallel World Dawn?
Someone posted this picture somewhere and they just said something like, "I think this woman needs another drink." And I looked at that and I was like, "I'm going to make that my Facebook."
It sort of seems like you know what my first assumption was, and maybe this indicates something bad about me or you or possibly both of us. My first assumption is that it was your mom.
I have pictures of my mom drunk, believe me.
I'm not going to say she looks like you, but I mean, if you told me that was your mom, I guess I could see it. There's a certain passing similarity there.
And that's what I thought when I saw it. I was like, it's me. It's me, only sort of a little less cared for.
Yeah.
And like half in the bag.
And like 20 years from now in a bingo hall somewhere.
Yeah.
You know?
And I was like, I know this woman. I identify with this woman.
Something familiar about her.
Of course, I realize that means that there are probably people who are going, "Oh my God, is that really what she looks like?"
It's sort of like it's like how for a while on her Facebook page, I think Sarah just had a picture of Lucille Bluth holding a cocktail.
Yeah.
And she was just sort of like me, circa 2030. You know, and it's like I don't doubt it at all. I dig that photograph though. So he just found it somewhere.
Yeah, somebody just recently I don't know why, but they just linked to that and said, "Look at this woman." And I was like, "Oh yeah, that's going up."
Awesome. All right. Let's see. I just improbably there are just there are so many Sambo's comments cropping up here. I don't even have time to read them. So I will skip instead of this one where a listener says, "Hey, by the looks of Patrick's glasses, I'm guessing his last name is Koresh." So
oh, I
he
can
does
see that.
Have a
yeah,
sort of Waco compound. We are all here to be a tool of the divine Jesus kind of a thing going on there. So, yeah, well done. Hey, speaking of Facebook, by the way, just real quickly, and then we'll do some news. We got some whatnot coming up, also some et cetera, and some ends and some odds.
Hmm.
Also some tit and some tat. And plus Anna Griffin from the Oregonian. So I'm glad that we're getting all of the... But we're getting all of the really, really awkward conversation out of the way so we can get back to the normal awkward conversation when she's in the room later of just penises and clowns.
Yes.
Let me ask you this about Facebook. So you got that photograph there of you. And again, you know, probably some people, I would imagine probably 10% of people look at that and they go, "Yeah, Dawn's a little older than I thought she was. She sounds youthful, though." But, you know, you see like a photograph of somebody and you go, "Huh. Okay, well, I guess that's what they look like," because most people probably don't go to the trouble of putting up a fake picture of themselves on Facebook. But if you notice this, do you notice is maybe the wrong word for it. Do you ever have this moment when you're going through your Facebook friend requests where you will automatically either, you know, reject or, you know, or whatever, ignore somebody or investigate them further because they are so attractive you think they can't possibly want to be your friend
in real life? I think they must be, it must be a scam.
Like, it's got to be some Facebook whore.
Are you selling something?
That's my thing. And it's, and, you know, and here's the really sad thing about it is, like, 90% of the time it's completely true. That I look and I go, I'm just, you know, clicking all of my accept, because I very rarely, like, what do you ever decline or ignore people for Facebook requests? I mean, if they're real people?
Not for Facebook. With Twitter, because Twitter, people can follow you, but you don't have to follow them back.
Right.
So I have a number of people that follow me on Twitter that they're basically promoting businesses or something like that. I will look to see who they are, and then I'll just go, no. Or if I look at their Twitter profile and they're just really boring, or they hardly ever write anything that's of interest, I won't read them. But it's like, you're free to follow me, whatever. Facebook, you have to, because you kind of have to follow each other for them to read your stuff, unless you make everything public, which I haven't. So I'll pretty much friend anybody back on
Facebook.
So
unless there's something squirrely about it, you just click accept.
I check to make sure they're an actual person. If they don't have any people in common with me at all,
right,
and if I don't understand why they're following me, a lot of times I won't follow them.
That's
back.
My thing too, is like, when in doubt, I look for the mutual friend thing, because there's been a spate of these recently, like a rash of like, it's just photographs of, like, really hot 19-year-old girls, you know? And it's like, "Cassandra wants to be your friend on Facebook." And I look at that and I immediately think, there's no way. There is no way, because I'm me and she's her, and there's no conceivable universe in which she wants to follow me.
By the way, this is unfair to the listeners, but this is not going online. But this is a photo somebody posted on Facebook. Just for your consumption, this is me with a couple.
Wait a minute, so this is on Facebook?
Well, yeah, somebody else.
It's on the internet.
Somebody else put it on their Facebook page. But I have that thing on Facebook where I don't let other people see photos of me, because there are so many horrible photos of me tagged.
So where is this?
Because of Renaissance Fair.
Where is this? Is this on your Facebook page?
This is on somebody else's Facebook page, but they tagged me, which means that,
right,
you know.
Yeah.
So, but I have that thing on Facebook where it's like, let other people see all the photos that other people have tagged of you. And I'm like, no.
Oh, I didn't
know
that was an option.
Yeah, no, no, no.
Okay.
Because here is me with two of my dear friends at the Renaissance Fair. And I am fat and drunk and in a costume. And the way I'm sitting, it looks like I have a mullet.
Okay. Let me just... That's not a bad photo at all.
Oh, don't say that. Do not say that.
There's nothing. I mean, it's not like what you'd put it like in your the profile for your stockholders at your company.
But I mean, but seriously, that's
there's nothing. I don't.
Oh,
I mean,
God.
your eyes are shut. You're the one on the right, right?
Yes.
I'm just checking to make sure that we're talking about the same picture. That doesn't look bad.
Yeah, no.
I mean, it's a candid shot where your eyes are closed. You don't look bad. Let me put it this way. I don't mean this. No offense. I've seen worse photos of you. I mean, that's a, you know.
No, well, I do not photograph well.
I'm just saying, in the grand scheme of things, that's not a photograph that I would worry about
really
all that much.
Here's me really fat with curly hair and sunglasses in a Hawaiian shirt.
Okay, now see, that photograph is a little, that is one that I wouldn't necessarily want people to see of me if I were you. Because, again, not a bad picture as such, like you don't look unattractive. You look very, very suburban and very old there, though. You look like you're about 50. When is that?
That was like 10 years ago.
You really do. This is a reference we make a lot on the show, but you look very Edie McClurg in that.
Oh,
you look
God.
Like you. Would you like some Tic Tac pie?
How about that one?
Oh, that's a bad photo.
Yeah,
see,
how
that
about
is,
that?
That's see now that, and I'll be honest, I'm not going to lie. That's a full on. What is up with your face in that picture? No offense.
Really, and that's the other thing is if you look at the background, there's my friend Liz. Liz, who currently sings in the chorus with the San Francisco Opera.
Uh-huh.
Liz is gorgeous. Liz is just freaking gorgeous. And then there's me in the foreground looking like a goddamn manatee.
Here's the thing.
A manatee in a wench costume.
And what is, and again, I keep saying no offense, but really, what is it with your eyes and like everything about your face there? It's like you look like you're in shadow, but you're not. So, and then your makeup seems to be a little intense.
And I'm sitting back and the skirt is poofing out, so I look like my stomach is just like, no! This is why no one is allowed to see photos of me.
Here's the thing about that photograph, and then we have to quit talking about it because it really is unfair to the audience because they can't see this. But all you need to know about the photograph is this, is it looks like a reverse photobombing where... It's like, because the thing about it is one of you is intruding on the other person's photograph, and I'm not sure which one. Because in some parallel world, they're talking to your friend Liz going, great photograph, Liz. You look really, really, you're framed perfectly, and it's like the light is coming up, and your eyes, but who's this woman to the left? And
oh,
it's
my
like,
Lord.
You're sort of intruding like, hi. in the photo.
Yes.
Yeah, but in this world, it almost... But here's the thing. In this world, it almost looks like somebody was taking a photograph of you, Dawn. But then at the last moment, your friend Liz thought, let me ruin her photograph. And then she just went like, ding, and just posed like the Good Witch Glenda. You know? Like, all that she's
missing... I'm going to be beautiful in your terrible photo.
The only thing that would make that more perfect is if she had, like, little animated birds landing on her shoulders. Hello, you're our favorite person, Mary Poppins. Well done. All right. Hey, I got something to put a smile on your face. I'm not going to read the story because the story itself is kind of boring, but I'm just going to read this to you. Here's one of my favorite headlines from the last couple of days because it contains one of my favorite phrases. It's the ending few words in this that are my favorite. Justin Bieber performance canceled on German TV show after stunt goes horribly wrong.
Oh,
there you go.
I like
the rest of the story is not that interesting, but it's just that. And so forth. I'm also going to ask you this question, then we should do a couple stories and we'll take a break.
Okay.
Where do hamsters come from? Don't say mommy and daddy hamster. And when they pay the kids to go to Chuck E. Cheese for a while. Are there wild hamsters?
I think so. I think hamsters and guinea pigs both come from, I'm pretty sure guinea pigs come from South America. So hamsters may live in the wild in, South America or something.
Are guinea pigs called that because it's some sort of slur?
I don't know.
I never thought about that because I was thinking they came from, New Guinea or something or wherever. Isn't that a place? That's an island
or
something.
Yeah,
it is. But then it occurred to me just now, I wonder what that's all about. I wonder if that's some sort of a... in any event. But hamsters, guinea pigs, I think, are found, in the jungle or the wild or something. Mm-hmm. I say just making it up, but it sounds plausible. But hamsters, not so much. I don't think that they really go into, they're not, in the deep, dark woods or on the Serengeti Plain finding hamsters.
No.
So the question is, where do they come from?
I really don't know.
And are they a hybrid of like mice and something else? We should ask. Don't look it up. We should ask Anna Griffin when she comes in.
We will.
That should be a test. We should ask her one bizarre science question every week, just as like her entree to the studio.
No, what I was looking up is I did get an email from a listener, because, of course, listeners do become outraged with our stupidity. We were talking about Bane during Legion of News today. And somebody wrote, a little bit more on Bane. In one story arc, Bane breaks Bruce's back, making him a paraplegic. Bruce, of course, got better.
Now, that's like the second time that is... Didn't that happen in the... the Dark Knight? The Frank Miller... Was it the Dark Knight Returns?
Broke his back?
Or is it Superman? Wasn't one of them... Or am I thinking of Killing Joke or something? Wasn't there a graphic novel where Batman had his back snapped in half?
I'm not sure. Maybe that was this. I don't know.
What was the... And I won't pretend to know. What was the Frank Miller thing? Was it Dark Knight or Dark Knight Returns?
It was both. Yeah, there was Dark Knight Returns was the...
There was a follow-up, though.
Yes, there was. I can't remember. Dark Knight Returns 2 or something.
Well, whatever.
The first
Dark Knight graphic novel that Miller did. I thought that there was a thing in there where Batman actually, like, had his back snapped. But I could be wrong about that.
Don't remember that.
All right. I don't really know what I'm talking about. All right. Doesn't matter. All right. It's the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. It is 503-505-6964. Later on, I'm going to tell you a phrase that needs to be stricken from our human vocabulary, from our national speech. It just needs to be removed from the lexicon of humanity. Also, Anna Griffin coming up, plus the top five coming up later on. We get the top five classic bubblegum songs of all time, plus your Taser Watch, your Clown Watch, and more. At the news desk, it's Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
Yeah.
On December 20th, the burglars broke into a home in Alice Springs, Australia.
I barely knew her.
Ed proceeded to cook a feast of a dozen eggs, fried chicken, and tomato sauce, and washed it down with some sparkling wine, which had been a wedding present. They also drank the homeowner's Southern Comfort and Cola. The burglars helped themselves to a glass of wine before opening the family's Christmas gifts and watching porn on their television. They then unwrapped... Then they ran off before they were when they were disturbed by the owners who were returning home.
It's a family that doesn't keep their porn very well hidden.
No. The property owners now plan to move away from their home and Alice Springs, probably because all the neighbors know they have porn.
Well, and just because the guys were just there just living it up, apparently. That would be creepy, the idea that a guy was, you know, or a guy and his accomplice, that they were at your house just sort of living the life of Riley on your dime.
Speaking to an Australian news service, they expressed their anger at being burgled and said, and I think more people should speak to news organizations this way, by the way. They said, we're bailing out of this S-hole. We've had enough.
Awesome.
There was a point when I loved this joint. The last one out. Don't forget to turn out the lights. You really can't print what my opinion is.
Awesome. And where is this?
This is Alice Springs, Australia.
Which is a bad place, apparently.
Alice Springs is dead center in the middle of the country, and it's where all the opal mines are, and people actually live underground there because it's so hot. It's where Ayers Rock is. And, it is an asshole.
Okay.
It really is. It's been suggested the burglary, which is one of a number in the area in recent weeks, is due to the region's alcohol restrictions, which have led to a crime wave as people have been breaking into houses to steal booze.
That's fantastic. All right.
So keep that in mind for loco restrictors.
And to our many Australian listeners, as well, if you're considering relocating within that fine continent, you might want to steer clear of that area. Mm. Although I imagine that probably goes without saying at this point.
If you're going to live anywhere in Australia, Alice Springs is definitely where you want to steer clear of. An Air Force sergeant and erstwhile swinger has been sentenced up to 8 years in prison for having unprotected sex with a variety of partners and exposing them to HIV without telling them about his condition. He was court-martialed on Wednesday. Tech Sergeant David Gutierrez was found guilty of 7 charges of aggravated assault for playing, quote, Russian roulette with his sexual partner's lives and violating his commander's order to notify partners about his HIV status and to use condoms. The Associated Press notes that the military is using the sentence to send a message about the integrity of its service members. Witnesses testified that Gutierrez regularly attended partner swapping events with his wife and repeatedly denied he was infected when questioned by other participants. In addition to the sentence, Gutierrez was dishonorably discharged and cut off from his military medical benefits, which he had begged the judge to let him keep. The possibility of a future without assistance does scare me, scares me to the core, he tearfully told the court. The cost of medicine is very expensive, and I don't know if I can afford it. Without proper medication, which doctors testify can cost up to $30,000 a year, HIV-infected patients usually die within 10 years.
Well, that's like one of those things where, and for a minute when he said tearfully, I thought you said cheerfully, and I was going to say, like, well done, you know, keeping a stiff upper lip, but I guess not. Well, that's like, you know, when we did the swingers club or whatever, and it's like, you know, and everywhere you go, there's like big bowls of rubbers or stuff, but they also did note that it was sort of optional. And I mean, well, you know, and I guess that's as it should be, because you have, as the Mormon Church would say, you have free agency. But I just can't imagine. I just can't imagine, just, you know, if it's optional, choosing the option of no, I'm just gonna go bareback. It just seems I don't think I would be physically able. I think I would actually be so anxious and apprehensive that I would be unable to perform at all, because you would just in the back of your head be seeing a high school textbook, you know, unfolding in front of you.
Well, yeah, I think you're pretty much crazy if you have sex with people that you would know nothing about and you don't use some form of protection.
Yeah, no, just that makes no sense.
And then just, you know, this is just sort of ridiculous because he endangered his entire career, obviously,
right.
and was dishonorably discharged because apparently, you know, it was known by his superiors that he was both HIV positive and swinging.
God almighty.
Yeah.
Somebody wants it to be known that hamsters come from the back of Fatboy Robert's old TV. Just FYI. All right. Let's do one more here and we'll take a break.
Snowfall and icy road conditions prompted officials in, this is a Hawaii thing and I can't pronounce it, and I wish Cheryl was here. Mekalekahai National Park to close Wednesday morning. I think it's Haleakala. Snow fell overnight and could be seen from all around Maui. TV viewers sent in photos to the local TV station of the snow-capped mountain. Park officials closed the park.
They didn't think it was some sort of angry white god falling from the sky.
They did, and then they just ate some poi. And
strange alabaster deity, cover all ground. Bring virgin to sacrifice.
I'm sorry, Cheryl. That's him. Park officials closed the park at 7,000-foot level early in the morning because of the conditions. They began turning visitors away at the gate when the parking lot filled up and rain started falling. The temperatures didn't begin rising in the morning, and the rains caused the icy road conditions. The park may reopen in the afternoon. It is the first snowfall in Maui of this winter.
By the way, you were apparently close. Cheryl has two comments. The first is, that's not quite it, but she was close. And then the second comment just says, really? So there you go. She says, yes, that's only when they leave their huts every day to catch fish, Rick. All right. Thanks so much. We should take a break here. It is the Rick Emerson radio program. Hey, you know, let me just say two things here. You know what Ryan White was exceptionally correct about? Well, two things. One, the new Social Distortion record, which is freaking awesome.
Oh, I can't wait.
It's so good.
I heard one song off of it that was released early, and it was really great.
Do you know what it was offhand?
No, I don't remember.
It was the single is this thing called Machine Gun Blues, which is great because it's set in sort of a I immediately am picturing it as being like a Boardwalk Empire kind of a thing, but it is told from the perspective of a 1930s gangster. And he talks about having a pinstripe suit and a Tommy gun and being on the run and burying money in the desert. And it's just, it's like, and with that cool, like, badass thing that only Mike Ness, who is from Anaheim, it's like that thing that only he can really, really get right. Just as John Fogerty, again, from Southern California, you know, is able to sing about, like, being in the bayou and floating down the river with Huck and Jim for some, you know, and you were like, I buy it, you know. But the new Social Distortion record is fantastic. What is also really good is the new Decemberists record, which Ryan White described completely accurately, as it turns out.
Well, that is his job.
It is the, well, you know, but it's that thing where it's like, you know, and I know he's a fan, and I'm not saying that he would be untruthful about it, but it's like, but I know he's a Decemberists fan, so he was maybe in a way not the one to assess this. He said it's a Decemberists record for people who have always tried to like the Decemberists but couldn't quite do it. And that is entirely accurate as well, because I listened to it last night. It's really, really good. And it's very sort of stripped down and basic and very pop. So.
And I've always really loved the Decemberists just as they are. So I'm actually looking forward to this as well. My friend Bobby Wiederquist, who you've met, he introduced me to the Decemberists. We had been talking about music, and I mentioned that I'd never heard them. This was, of course, years ago. And he burned me a couple of CDs of the Decemberists and of Neutral Milk Hotel.
Yeah.
And both bands, which I immediately loved and have loved ever since.
So you got your, let it be dealer's choice here. Would you rather hear Social Distortion or The Decemberists?
Social Distortion.
All right. So we'll do the, I believe this is the single. This is called Machine Gun Blues. We'll be back with Anna Griffin from The Oregonian. Later on, we get your top five classic bubblegum songs of all time. Clown Watch, Taser Watch, and more horrible and off-putting stories of every conceivable stripe and fashion.
Aye.
It is the Rick Emerson radio program. Stay right there.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Listening to the Emerson News Network.
Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-505-6964. Thank you for joining us. So that's the first single from the new Social Distortion record, which is called, the album is called Hard Times and Nursery Rhymes, and it's got the best album art, by the way. That is a thing, I don't mean to sound like an old guy, but it's just, it's not like I really sit around and pine for the days of vinyl records as such, because there's a pain in the ass, and it's like you had to get up and walk across the room every 22 minutes or something. And it's like the only way that you could avoid doing that is if you did the, if you had that, if you did that jazz re, like, you stacked up the records, like, you know, it had, and it had the weird, like, the arm or whatever, not the tone arm, but the arm that we would pile the records on top and then it would drop a new one when you were done. But even then, it's like you could never really hear an entire album all the way through. You would just hear, like, all the side A's, and then you have to go flip them over and do all the side B's. But the one thing that we really are missing out on these days is cover art, and just the ability to sit there and just stare at the cover art for hours on end with a sort of rapt fascination that you can really only conjure up when you were either stoned or an adolescent or some confluence of the two. But the cover art for the new Social Distortion record is fantastic because it looks like it is done in the style of one of those old dime store pulp novels. And it's where it's got like the cool old font and it says like 10 cents up in the corner. And it's got like a sort of, and they do, the design is such that the left-hand side sort of looks like, it looks like the worn spine of a book. It really is, it is quite beautiful. And so that song is called Machine Gun Blues. Nice. Hello, Don Taylor.
To update something earlier, our listener Meta, who had, had emailed about Bane
is
earlier.
Is that the listener that talks about themselves all the time?
Yes. That was cute.
Zam.
Email to let us know that the comic book story arc in which Bruce Wayne had his back broken, was crippled by Bane, was the Nightfall story arc from 1993.
Well, then what the hell am I thinking of?
I don't know, but the story took place over approximately 6 months, according to Wikipedia, in which Bruce Wayne suffers burnout and is systematically assaulted and crippled by a super steroid-enhanced genius named Bane. Wayne is replaced as Batman by an apprentice named John Paul Valley, who becomes increasingly violent and unstable, tarnishing Batman's reputation. Eventually, Wayne is healed through paranormal means and reclaims his role as Batman.
It must be, you know, simultaneously the easiest and hardest job in the world to write comic books. Because there is no such thing. I don't think anybody who is a comic reader ever complains about, you know, wait a minute, that was just some Deus Ex Machina resolution. It just came out of nowhere. I mean, you can just sort of, you know, like at the end of it, like it can just all be like some fever dream that Mitzelplick had. All right. Well, in any event.
Apparently, there are a lot of Batman villains, by the way, because it was saying that they're talking about this story apparently had a lot to do with a bunch of freed inmates from
Arkham Asylum.
Including the Joker and the Scarecrow, and they said including many lesser known villains such as Mad Hatter, the Ventriloquist,
Waffle Guy,
Firefly, Cavalier, the Film Freak, and Victor Zsasz.
Victor Zsasz is great. Victor Zsasz sounds like a guy who would run a sort of really exotic shoe emporium in Lower Manhattan, and he would be sort of swarthy and have it. He would have a mustache out to here, and he would just sort of say, "Welcome to my shoery."
Yeah.
Or perhaps not. Is the Film Freak the guy that was? What's going on with you over there?
I just inhaled some Chex Mix into my lungs.
Really? Is this Chex Mix that you had before the show today? From maybe a Chex Mix from early this morning?
No, this would be Chex Mix I just grabbed out of the snack box just now.
Really? Just now, rooting around inside there like a raccoon rooting around inside a knot hole?
Because unlike yesterday, today I actually brought lunch.
Uh-huh. How's that working out for you?
I failed to eat it.
Okay.
So and at 1 o'clock at the break, I had. Your favorite thing to watch me eat, a couple of raw hot dogs.
Here's the thing about your...
And a hard-boiled egg.
Your dietary behaviors, you have a sort of culinary pachinko thing going on, where it doesn't matter what the root is, it all ends up in the same tray at the bottom. And the tray is you just reaching inside going, are there any of those mother's cookies in here? I'm just, you know, it would just be my...
You know, I am actually very picky about what I eat.
Okay.
I really am. Uh-huh. I just have a wide array of foods that I find palatable.
Let me just say this one final thing before we bring Anna Griffin onto the show. This now raises to, I think five, and three of them are today, moments where I realized that I ought to just either A, have my camera in my hand all the time, like have the iPhone just, and constantly just like with the shutter setting, you know, so I can just go and just capture something, or just to be stashing like a camera somewhere in the dark corners of the studio, because there was the moment when I came in from the kitchen and you like had and you were just and I swear to God I'm not trying to pick on you about this, but
oh,
it was like,
I know.
The box is now, the contents of the box are it's not empty, but I mean most of the snacks in the box from the age vending are gone.
It's about 12 bags of something, and then all of those loose cheddar fries that you dumped in the box for some reason.
But you were like shoulder deep in there, man.
It's a big box and they're all the way down in the bottom.
It was like you were like a dad trying to get Timmy out of the well, where you're like, can you feel my fingers? You know?
I have these days when I see myself through your eyes and I realize that I just look like a bear rooting through the garbage pile at Yellowstone looking for old Pringles. You know,
the poo to my Eeyore. I will say that the other moment today, and this may be a thing that I imagined, but I'm almost certain, and I think past evidence would indicate that it is not something that I just hallucinated. Did I look over at one point this morning and see you? Let's just welcome Anna Griffin before I even say this. Hello, Anna Griffin for the Oregonian.
The answer
How are you?
Is probably yes, whatever it was.
Just because I want to give you a chance to explain yourself. Is it possible that I looked up this morning and you just had a credit card out and you were sort of just racking out white lines of something with a credit card?
No.
Uh-huh.
I waited too long. Again, I needed to take a Vicodin.
Right.
The knee was hurting. I was achy. But I had forgotten to take medication earlier, and we were about to start the show. So to just sort of jumpstart the painkiller.
To skip to the bottom of the page, as it were.
I ground it up into a fine powder so it would dissolve and go into my bloodstream that much quicker, using the bottom of a shot glass. And then I used my key card that allows me to get into the building to scrape it from the top of the table into the cap of the pill bottle and then knock it back into
the mouth. I was right about everything except the word that precedes card.
And lines. I was not racking up lines. I was just...
They were sort of...
It was a pile.
And then for lunch, you had two raw hot dogs and a hard-boiled egg?
Well, I forgot to eat the hot dogs and the hard-boiled egg. So now I'm eating Chex Mix and Rolos.
I'm going to sell you for medical experiments at some point. Because here's the thing. You talk a lot of times about, you know, how you feel like you're in bad shape, or your body, you're not treating your body very well, or maybe you just, you know, you're just not feeling like you're really in the swing of things because you're mistreating your metabolism. But I think at this point, it almost is the opposite. I think you must just be like have some sort of unbreakable thing going on over there, because I think you ought to be dead.
Yes, I would, that's probably true.
All right, then. Anna Griffin from the Oregonian, you write a twice-weekly column on life in Portland and in Multnomah County, part of these United States. How are you?
I'm troubled. What did I walk into today?
Really, here's the sad or great thing, depending on how you view it. It really is not that different from most of our other shows.
It's good, because I'm feeling a little unwell, and
Oh, you were in a sick house.
I've been on. Yeah. We're not good. The children are plague.
They're germ farms.
They're like rats in 17th century England.
No, every kid is like a little patient zero, and it's like they're just bringing some horrible dread disease home from like a play date somewhere.
Well, it's like they don't sleep, they don't eat properly, they scream all the time.
So my wife this last weekend was in Eugene with some of her godless hippie friends, and so not only did they have children, so there's like a kid that like the son I think is five, and the daughter's like two or something. So it's like, you know, at any given moment, it's like they're two knuckles deep in the nose, you know, and it's like, you know, and then just, what are you doing? I'm eating piles of dirt. Okay, you know, and it's like they're just doing whatever kids do. And they're not fully formed, I would imagine, in some ways. You know, their immune system only has a couple of years of practice. But also, like, it's like one of those families where it's like they think inoculations and vaccinations are a plot from the government. That it's like, you know, that Donald Rumsfeld has like a tracking device they want to put in your kids' teeth, you know, by way of a polio vaccine. So they make sure that they avoid all of that. So as a result, my wife has just been exposed to an entire family who themselves are probably, I mean, they're probably just like human-shaped petri dishes at this point.
If
just
polio
walking
is
around.
Contagious, you have it now.
Yeah. I mean, that's the, you know, yeah. So it's, so that was her weekend. So to no one's surprise, she was back here like a day and a half and immediately started feeling unwell, which is the thing that I have some sympathy for, but a limited amount, because it's like if you voluntarily put yourself, you know, in close circulation with people like that. I mean, yeah. Look, if you lie down with...
You spend a weekend with uninoculated children and probably, like, eating hemp cookies and drinking kombucha.
Yes, exactly.
You know, of course you come home sick.
Exactly, where it's like, yeah, the only... And that's... And there is no actual medicine given of any kind. It's like, have a tiger's milk bar and some carob, you know, and that's... you'll be back on top in no time. So, well... In any event, I'm glad to see that you are, because you weren't actually ill. It was just everybody around you.
I have a sort of existential illness.
Okay.
I just don't like anybody.
All right, then. You're going to fit in perfectly today.
What I thought.
She came down with angst.
It is, I think, actually, was right before the show today, as we were getting ready to, between Legion of News and this show, I don't remember what I was reading that actually prompted me to say this, but it was one of those things where you just sort of, you're saying stuff out loud and you're not really aware of it until somebody else observes it. And right as we were getting ready to do the show, I was just answering some email, and I just muttered under my breath, I said, "God damn effing people." Just sort of this like this incredibly like pointed dismissive tone in my voice. And then Dawn sort of arched her eyebrow, and she said, "What was that about?" And I didn't remember. That's the thing. I don't even remember at this point.
I don't really think that's the kind of thing you need to explain, though. No. I think that that's just, yes, that is the human condition.
Any one of a dozen things it could be. So we'll go back to the news desk here in a second, when we'll talk about what's coming up in the Oregonian. We got the top five coming up later on today, which is the top five classic bubblegum songs of all time, in honor of the passing of Mr. Don Kirshner. I should say, by the way, because I've already gotten questions about this, I had a couple of rules for making the top five classic bubblegum list. Classic is sort of, it's an arbitrary and somewhat relative distinction, but I mean, I think we all kind of know the era we're talking about. Also, I had a no monkeys, no Archies rule, only because the top five should ideally contain some element of surprise. And also, I think we just played the Monkees really recently. They were on some list. And I think we actually just played the Archies. And also the Archies, Sugar Sugar is the bed for the E.H. Vending segment. So it can be no Archies, no Monkees. But they're sort of like that. Those are jerseys that are hanging in the bubblegum rafters. I mean, it's like that point has been made. So we'll get to that later on as well. Before we do any of that, though, Don and I decided that we wanted to ask you this question because we didn't know the answer to it. And the question is, where do hamsters come from? I mean, there aren't wild hamsters somewhere, are there?
Feral hamsters, free-range hamsters.
Are there? I see. I would laugh at that, except that I once said that there were no such thing as wild cows, and apparently there aren't so much anymore, but there were, in fact, wild cows that evolved into domesticated cows, which I did not know. So it's possible with hamsters.
I'm going to guess that they were bred, don't you think? They were bred from something?
My guess was that they were a cross between mice or rats and something else, you know, and some other, yeah, you said guinea pig or something?
And a paperweight, yes.
But I have no idea. I really have no...
Yeah, we really don't know.
So we were trying to avoid looking it up.
I'm assuming they must actually exist and they come from somewhere. Because like we said, you know, like I was saying, guinea pigs, I believe, are from South America because they're similar to capybaras and things like that. So they're actually, you know.
They're like what?
Not capybara. Isn't capybaras the world's largest?
That's a thing from Super Mario Brothers, I think.
No, the world's largest rodent. They're huge rodents. But they're similar to those. They're similar to guinea pigs, except the size of dogs. But I think guinea pigs, I'm fairly sure guinea pigs come from South America.
Okay. So, yeah. So hamsters come from somewhere else
maybe
in the world.
Scandinavia.
Than here.
Scandinavia.
Finland.
That's what we're going to say. All right. Excellent. Yeah. At the news desk, it is Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
Australian soldiers who are entitled to taxpayer-funded Viagra pills have been warned about the dangers of erectile dysfunction drugs and told that they may have just 4 tablets a month. Defense personnel, including those on active duty in places such as Afghanistan, have also been informed that they must be medically assessed as suffering from sexual performance problems before the pills will be prescribed to them.
How do you medically assess that?
I'm really not sure.
Is that where you just...
Well, here's a picture of Megan Fox.
Doesn't that naturally, though, if you're having something prescribed to you by a doctor, therefore, aren't you being medically assessed in just having the discussion with the doctor before they write the prescription?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they can. Yeah, they can.
Or when you're in the military, can you just go to the PX and just ask for stuff?
It's in a vending machine.
Yeah.
I don't think so. No, I mean, I think you have to, like, I don't know. You have to go and see a guy and he asks you, you know, hey, what about it? And you say, no, not so much. And he says, oh, poor lad, here you go. And then he gives you a bottle or something, I guess. Although I guess maybe the theory is, and this is probably not without some basis, maybe the theory is that doctors are a little bit, that they have somewhat of a heavy hand with the dispensation of Viagra, you know, that they just sort of give it out to anybody. And that therefore, because I think it is, doesn't it have, it's full of nitrates or something? I mean, it's bad for your heart if you take tons of it.
If you have high blood pressure, it can be bad for you.
Yeah, because it does some whole thing of, I don't know, like relaxing something or other or dilating something. And it's one of those things where if you take it, like your heart just blows out of your rib cage or whatever.
Well, the question I have is that they were saying that the Defense Department, whatever the Defense Department of Australia is called, the Surgeon General issued a health bulletin in response to concerns about possible overuse and overprescribing of the drugs by military personnel. And the warning applies to Viagra and Cialis and states that a proper diagnosis must be made before troops can qualify for the drugs. Service personnel deployed overseas who qualify to receive the drugs continue to obtain them on deployment.
What are these guys doing in Afghanistan?
Don't you have better things to be doing with your time in Afghanistan?
Now, again, are these U.S. service people?
No, this is Australia.
Okay. Well, I mean, they're Australian.
Where they hand them out like cigarettes, it sounds like.
I guess. I mean, what do you need a boner on demand for when you're in Afghanistan on deployment in the army? I'm sorry.
Sometimes I can't quite tell if you're actually asking me to weigh in on something or if it's just sort of – if it is the very definition of a rhetorical question. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, maybe maybe there's some sort of a I got nothing. I have no idea. Especially because it seems like the opportunities for sexual congress in Afghanistan are necessarily finite. And I would say perhaps don't present themselves all that often. But then again, what do I know?
You could be having sex with someone that – is also in the service with you.
Well, I suppose.
But at the same time, I'm thinking, well, should you be, really? Shouldn't you be doing other things? And if there's an issue where, like, you can't, maybe you should just accept that and go about your business of polishing your gun and blowing things up.
Now, see, I would say that is two things. One, I would say that let's work backward from that second comment to go to the first. I would say that is a very female perspective on the situation. The idea of, like, so you can't get it up or have sex. So what? Like, I think that is I think that is just both attitudinally and physiologically. I think that is coming from the opposite side of sexual canyon. That's you're in one county and we're in another over here.
Can
with the Y chromosomes.
Can you yodel across sexual canyon? What comes back?
I think the idea that you're just supposed to like just sort of like suck it up, you know, just sort of tough it out. I mean, I don't know, go for a jog or something.
Well, I guess when you're in the military, not every single minute of your day is spent like killing guys and digging ditches and doing stuff. You do have some time off, and maybe you might want to dally.
This was going to be my next thing, is that I think, and again, I don't know because it's not like I've been over there or whatever, but the general sort of assessment, the general assessment of this particular Mideast conflict that we seem to hear a lot is that it is just these long, long, drawn-out sections of just tedium and boredom. And it's just excruciating dullness, then just interspersed by moments of terror where you think you're going to die. So I would say really, A, you got a lot of time to kill. The idea of like, don't you have something better to be doing? The answer I think is no. I think that's kind of provably the case.
So maybe that explains why they have to like limit the amount of pills they can have is because they have so much time on their hands. They're just going,
just going to be napping the entire time, you know? These soldiers.
Well, I guess I'll just give myself an erection again and kill some time.
I'm just going to be over here chafing away. Don't worry about me. And also, I would say that really, I don't know what the situation is in Australia, if they have a draft or if it's like you voluntarily enlist. But I'd say if you're spending your days, you know, if your days are spent between some combination of thinking you're going to be killed and then actually avoiding people who are trying to kill you actively, then probably you should have all the Viagra you want. And really, I mean, if you can get your sex on, you know, at some point, have at it. I mean, that's the least we can do, I think.
Yeah, I guess.
That was like the thing about... You know, it's like the thing about Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky and whatever. I mean, obviously it's not an ideal situation because of the power differential and whatever. But I mean, it doesn't matter to me if when the guy got into office, it's like we were talking about Barack Obama and how they were saying that he looked a little run down, a little stressed out, and he was losing a lot of weight and didn't seem to be sleeping a whole lot, and how there ought to just be, and I'm surprised there isn't, just some guy that just comes into the Oval Office with a syringe of whatever you want. Like, it doesn't matter, you know? What could you? I'd like a bowl full of Benzedrine. And he says, okay, here you go. Because if you're the president of the United States, that is a job that I think has requirements and stressors that do not come along with most other forms of employment. So whatever it is, it's going to get you through the day, you know? I mean, you know...
Boffing an intern.
I was going to say, maybe it's a whole hockey team coming to the Oval Office after dark. It doesn't matter. Whatever. As long as everybody's okay with it.
I would argue there's a difference between, say, Obama sneaking a cigarette, which he's been known to do, and bopping an intern.
But I'm saying maybe wouldn't have to sneak a cigarette if he was not deprived of the other options that that might have the same... Look, endorphins are endorphins. There's you know, you can get them one way or another.
I don't think he's having any problems with Michelle. I think...
Yeah,
They look fairly robust and happy.
And actually, to be honest, he doesn't really look that bad to me. They keep trying to make the case recently that he looks sort of run down, but I think it's just that he's fit. I think it's just that everybody in America is sort of spongy, and so when you see a guy who's not, you immediately wonder if there's something wrong with him.
He's gotten very gray.
very quickly.
Well, that job.
Which the job does.
That, yeah, that happens to pretty much everybody.
That ages you like in dog years. I mean, it's like you look at, I mean, anybody, like Clinton, I mean, you know, was the same way. And I mean, granted, he was impeached and everything, but it's like you look at any president and it's like
from four years.
First term to second term.
Yeah, 4 years tends to age them about 10.
Well, and if you notice this too, the thing about the presidency, from what I have seen anyway, is that it's like doing heroin. It's not the heroin itself that ages you, it's the cessation. It is when you stop. Because like you look at Jimmy Page, and he looked about the same way from like 1973 to 1989. And then you saw him in 1991, and it was like – and you suspected that there was a really beautiful portrait of him in an attic somewhere because he looked terrible. And that was like Bill Clinton. As soon as Clinton got out of office, man, it's like he started turning into a pumpkin. It was just – it was bad. I don't even know what we're talking about here. Penises. So I'm just saying – it just seems like that is you can't smoke anywhere. You can't, many forms of recreation and amusement have been closed off to us in our somewhat newly puritanical society. If you're some service guy over there and, in between the, firefights, you can, get some local chick to get on with you. I mean, that's what we're fighting for, really. That freedom, Don.
Well, now that we've repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell, it could also be a local guy.
I'm just saying whoever.
Or another fellow that you're in the service with. It could be anyone.
I'm pretty sure this is why the Taliban hates us.
Well, but I mean.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
But doesn't that show that we're on the side of right, though?
Because we're pro-erection.
I say
here
for myself,
America.
Yes, solidly yes. I don't even have any. I'm not even gonna split that up into percentages. Yes, we are solidly, firmly.
Can we do the clown watch?
Throbbingly
now?
In favor, Don. What are we doing?
Let's do the clown watch.
All right, here's your clown watch for. Here's your clown watch for Thursday. On the Rick Emerson radio program. Unbelievably, I should note this. Before you got here, before you were actually in the studio the other day, the show was so much more inappropriate than it was even in like the last 10 minutes.
Oh, I'm disappointed.
We try
to clean it up when you get here. We really do.
It's sort of like...
like somebody's mom.
It's like when somebody's coming over to your house and you're just taking all the dirty dishes and hiding them in the stove or just tossing everything out in the dumpster in the back so that your company doesn't see it. You would not believe what we got rid of in the first half an hour of
the show.
I did walk in
and Dawn was hip deep in a box of
snacks.
Yeah. Delicious E.H. Vending junk food.
Yeah. Here is your clown watch for Thursday.
A Miami theater goer claims a clown in the Tony Award-winning Slava's Snow Show jumped on his chest during a show and refused his repeated request to get off him, permanently injuring him. Slava's Snow Show won the 2009 Tony for theatrical effects. Mark Mizla claims the Broadway show and the Adrian Arsh Center, quote, failed to adequately protect his business invitees. In his complaint in Miami-Dade County Court, Mizla said that on or about August 9, 2008, a clown performer for Snow Show negligently jumped onto Mizla's chest, causing him to fall to the ground and sustain substantial and permanent injuries to his back. Despite repeated requests by Mizla for the performer to get off his chest, the performer refused to do so, and Mizla had to be taken to the emergency room by paramedics.
I'd be curious to know what percentage of people who go into the clowning profession, who attend a clown college or who find themselves in some sort of a career where they're slathering on grease paint and squirting people and going, hey, hey, and then jumping off and landing on a guy's sternum. What percentage of them have some sort of antisocial disorder or personality dysfunction?
Oh, I thought you were going to ask what percentage of them end up with lawsuits against them.
I would imagine a goodly percentage. But don't you think there's something, I'm not going to say even something wrong, but something fundamentally other about somebody who pursues clowning as a job, as a career?
Oh, yes.
I mean, there's...
Well,
there's,
you know how I feel about clowns.
There's something at play there deep in the basement of one's mind, if that's how you're going to earn your living.
Well, Mizla's claim is that the show and the Performing Arts Center failed to advise the invitees that performers would engage in such activity. And failed to protect them, and otherwise failed to exercise due care in securing its patrons from physical danger. The show was created by Russian-born performance artist Slava Pulinin. Mizla claims that as a direct and proximate result of its breach of duty, he suffered substantial and permanent injuries to his back. He is suing Snow Show USA and the Performing Arts Center Trust for damages, including hospital expenses, medical and nursing care, loss of earnings, and aggravation of a previously existing condition.
Does it explain exactly what in the show required the clown to jump out and land on a guy's, thorax or whatever?
No, just that apparently a clown jumped on his chest.
Is this sort of like when Eddie Van Halen leaps off the stage, like down into one of the stage monitors
except
or something?
Except with clown shoes, so it's even worse.
Seriously, just yeah. Right on the. All right, okay. There's your. Let's just end this. There's your clown watch for Thursday, the Rick Emerson radio program. This is like the ninth day in a row, by the way, that we've had a clown watch. So there does seem we are passing some sort of clown event horizon.
I like it. It had clowns and a dumb lawsuit and Florida all in one.
It is the most American of stories. This is like in Maximum Overdrive. We're just passing through the tail of a comet right now, but it's not affecting gas pumps. It's just guys named Shecky who have spinning bow ties and whatnot. By the way, Don, somebody wanted to. We have two observations. One, this guy says, "Let's see, where did it go?" Says, "Attention, attention, Don. Soldiers have needs too. Why do you deny me love, Don Taylor?" Followed by, having spent time in Iraq, I have to say there is lots and lots and lots of downtime for sex. I'm just saying. So, says Greg. Let's see. And then somebody else who is anonymous wants it known that the Frito Bandito is, in fact, a man, because otherwise it would be the Frito Bandita.
Oh, yeah.
So I guess we could have figured that out ourselves if only we had, like, even a tenuous grasp of how language operates or functions. Hi, we're not that bright.
No.
It is the Rick Emerson radio program. Joining us, a woman who was far brighter than Dawn and I put together and tripled, Anna Griffin from the Oregonian.
Still feeling bad that I don't know where hamsters come from.
I think we have an answer to that that is incoming, by the way.
Oh,
so somebody is apparently, they are compiling
listeners,
the information.
People.
They're
gonna take it all back.
We have said before that it is the power of distributed computing, where it's like you throw the net out, you trawl for a while, you haul it up, you look through it, there's going to be the answer.
Should we reiterate that we love soldiers and want them to get laid? Just, it's the Viagra thing's
true.
A little weird.
To me, it's just the weird, we got sidetracked almost immediately, and that's right. The weird thing to me was the idea that you have to go to the doctor's office, because that's a thing that I guess, I mean, you were talking about, like, they strap electrodes on your junk and then they show you a picture of, Matthew McConaughey, anything at all. But I don't think they really do that outside of, like, episodes of like ER or something.
Or Fox News.
And they certainly don't, or at BYU, if they're trying to get rid of the wrong feelings.
Here's a picture of a Diet Coke.
Yeah. And then there's a guy just...
Oh, they love Diet Coke at BYU.
Guy just reaching for the tasing button.
The freaky thing I've learned about Mormons in my most recent thing of befriending many Mormons, as I have, is that they're not allowed to drink coffee. Coffee is bad. Coffee is a drug. But caffeine itself... they're split on, and many, many Mormons are huge on drinking Diet Coke.
Diet Coke is a drug. It's good.
Lara's parents are huge consumers of Pepsi and Diet Pepsi because the prohibition, alleged prohibition against there actually is no prohibition against caffeine. This is one of those things where it's ridiculous that the church is even split on it because it's never mentioned. The word of wisdom, which is which is a supplemental revelation which describes the consumption of beverages and foods and things, actually does not ever mention caffeine. There is a prohibition against strong drinks. And it is like everything else in religion. It's just this interpretation.
So like RC would be fine. Coke would be a problem.
It seems like it seems like maybe if you were going a little too overboard with the flavors, if you were having
Dr. Pepper, no way.
If it was like a sort of the Dr. Skipper, yeah, you can't go down that road. Or something that has like both cherry and lime, no. or that chocolate mint soda that Cragmont used to sell back in the 80s.
Oh,
you certainly couldn't have that. Yeah, but it doesn't actually say caffeine at any point. It's just one of those things that they have sort of. At some point, some guy somewhere at the Sunday sermon just interpreted it that way and said it, and then it just sort of spread and it became the belief.
It's like somebody in the audience had brought in a can and just opened it, and he was annoyed.
No!
Well, somebody at some point decided it was coffee, and then there was question about whether it was the drug, the caffeine in the coffee, or if it was just coffee. And apparently it's been decided among most Mormons now that they're like— Yeah, but we love Diet Coke, so we're just going to say that, that doesn't count.
Proving that really, that as many, as often as there are comparisons made between Mormons and Jews, really, the closest comparison is the Mormons and Catholics, where they just, it's sort of an a la carte. It's kind of a Chinese menu religion. You go, I'm going to follow that and that, not these three things, but that, but not this. For example, the fact that nowhere is it written that that Mormon men should not have facial hair. But in contemporary times, you will almost never see an active Mormon man who has a beard or a mustache.
Is it written that young Mormon men can't wear long sleeve dress shirts? Is that why all of them appear at my doorstep in short sleeve dress shirts?
No, I don't know. I think they just do that.
I think they're a frugal people.
And also they do that for comfort in the warmer months when they're on their the missions, because they're riding around on bicycles and they're walking door to door. But they still have to wear the white shirt and the tie. So I think that's the compromise, is they wear the short-sleeved white shirt because it's a little bit cooler.
I feel now like I should say also that, like soldiers, I love Mormons and would like them to get laid too. I just, you know, have questions about certain details.
I was just going to say that I think that the short shirts are actually just to keep – it's like just to preserve the dorky appearance so that they don't – so there's less temptation to avoid. Because let's be honest, if you're going door to door, you know, and you look like a tool, really, you know, there's a lot less sex that you're going to have to turn down from housewives who might answer the – the other thing is, I think it's also maybe to prevent a binding, like if they really – like if they have to reach for the Bible really quickly at some point, sort of like – you know, kind of like Lee Van Cleef reaching for the gun.
Gunslingers,
yeah, exactly. You know?
A quick draw competition with a Baptist.
I was just saying there's a Seventh-day Adventist and, you know.
Just rode into town.
Quick, where is your Bruce R. McConkie? And then you reach for it and you just pull it on out. All right. I'm so sorry to everybody. This, by the way, is why whenever my in-laws ask about getting a subscription or like getting comp to listen to the show, and my wife just goes, "Yeah, I'll get right on that," and then she just never, never ever does it. She just doesn't ever get back to you. My wife has never ever ever been happier than the day that this show went to a subscription basis, which meant that her dad couldn't just sit at home and just listen in and just, you know, and you hear whatever filth was coming out of my mouth. I mean, it was bad enough that they like. It's one of those things where you don't really think about stuff until it's viewed through somebody else's third-person perspective. And it's like I had never really thought about all the stuff that was on my webpage and just some of the, you know, just some of the, like in my bio and just the way I described living in Salt Lake, where I lived for 4 or 5 years. And I was talking about the aesthetic appeal I found in and the behaviors exhibited by some of the female population of Utah. And her parents saw that. It's like as soon as – she's like, this is the boy I'm going to marry. And they went online and looked at my webpage, and there was just like a whole long conversation they had with her that I didn't have to be in on, but which I think was exceedingly unpleasant. So putting this whole show behind just some sort of a Great Wall of China has really been a boon for her and her relationship with her parents. I was going to say something else. Wait. No, wait. Well, you would think that the ban on caffeine would extend. Here's how you know it's not caffeine, by the way, is because if it was the ban, if the word of wisdom actually said that you were not supposed to have caffeine, then you couldn't have chocolate either, because chocolate contains caffeine. So it's one of those things that has just been, it has become a colloquialized commandment.
Yeah, that was one of those things that really got cleared up for me at Mormon Book Club, and it was because I showed up and there were just these huge 2-liter bottles of Diet Coke and Diet Dr. Pepper and stuff sitting around. And Mr. Eric D. Snyder and I were enjoying the Diet Dr. Pepper. And I was watching Josh, our host, just suck down glass after glass of Diet Coke. And it came up that he is just completely addicted to it and drinks massive amounts of Diet Coke. And he said, well, you know. And I'm like, but I didn't think you were – and then they schooled me on the whole coffee versus the Diet Coke thing, and how if you go to Salt Lake, you will see people just walking down the street
with those
giant tankers from 7-Eleven full of Diet Coke.
I have never – let me just tell you this. I have never, never, ever been to a city – I have never lived anywhere where people carried more of those huge ass – like they're like little igloo coolers basically.
The one beyond the big gulp.
Yeah, with a straw in the top. Yeah. And you just take it into like into your plaid pantry or your 7-Eleven whatever and just – and you just fill it up and then they just carry it around with them for the rest of the day. I mean it's like those shots of Neil Armstrong on the moon where he's carrying the little oxygen valise with him. I mean everywhere they go. It's like they are simultaneously always teetering on the verge of dehydration of the most horrific sort, and like a caffeine withdrawal that's going to kick in, and their immune system is just going to implode. So it's like they have to be armed at every moment with that. So it's a strange place. It really is. Have you ever been to Salt Lake?
No, but you make it sound wonderful.
It's not wonderful, but it is fascinating.
If I could get away with that, that appeals to me.
It really
is. The Mormon temple there is an amazing work of architecture. It really is. I mean, the other thing that I remember most from Salt Lake City is it smells terrible.
Yes.
The Salt Lake itself is just a horrible cesspool of filth and feces and rotting fish and salt. And it's just the nastiest smelling thing. And the whole town of Salt Lake City, therefore, smells like the Salt Lake. And it's horrible. It's indescribable how bad that smells.
When I was the closer you get to – and, of course, like everybody else,
Why don't they advertise that, I wonder?
The Great Salt Lake itself is sort of, and I'm sorry, because I know we have a lot of listeners in Utah, and whatever. And so I'm not trying to, but they know. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. People who live there, I've made the observation before that when my wife moved to Portland, it was a real revelation to her that there were people who lived in a place that they liked. That, people here they're like, hey, Portland is awesome. Portland rules. Or like in San Diego, people are like, hey, isn't it a great city where, we're so glad we live here. And in Utah, you ask people like, do you like it here? And they just kind of go, and then they wake up and they kind of stare out the window for a while in the morning going, well, another day in Utah. And then there's like 70 years of that, But so people there know. But the Salt Lake is sort of microcosmic. It is representative of Utah as a whole in that it looks really pretty and amazing, and it's sort of astounding, and it's beautiful, and it's representative of God's handiwork in crafting out this swath of beauty out of the hardscrabble landscape. And you sort of think to yourself like, well, and they disagree about whether or not the pioneers thought it was the West Coast. There was some discussion that they thought they had reached the ocean because it was the salinity of it. But, it's about man's ability to make a life anywhere. And it represents all that is deep and true about the human spirit. But then you get close to it, and it just reeks, and it's filled with dead shrimp that float to the surface.
Well, and also they settled there, and then they just used this beautiful salt lake basically
as a
sewage system for generations.
It's their Willamette, but it's much shallower, so you can draw your own conclusions. Like everybody else, when I moved to Salt Lake, the first thing it is, I got to go to the Great Salt Lake. It's awesome. And people would warn me. It's like, I always tell people, like, don't go to the top of the Statue of Liberty. Like, it's pointless. It is a waste of 6 hours of your life. But I didn't listen. And I went to the Salt Lake. And the first thing you notice is, A, it's hot. B, there's sand and salt blowing everywhere into your eyes, and you can't really see anything. And you feel like – by the time you get out of there, you feel like somebody – you realize why sand is what they make sandpaper out of. Your clothes smell like filth, and you've been savagely bitten by these things that are called – you'll sometimes hear them called brine flies. But they are these flies that just hover over like still standing stagnant water. And they just bite you savagely and without mercy. And it just takes like days. And you'll see people that are like, they are covered head to toe. And it looks like they've just – like somebody's gone after them with a set of darts. And you can't quite figure out why until you realize they went to the Salt Lake. But it's just but that right there – when I saw the Ramones played at this place called Salt Air, which is an indoor venue. But it's like the Roseland, but it's right near the Great Salt Lake. And so I'm there and I'm seeing the Ramones, and they don't typically talk a lot between songs. They just kind of do the 1, 2, 3, 4 and they go right into it. But they're playing and they get like – I don't know. They do a couple songs and then they just stop. Joey Ramone with that like delivery that only Joey Ramone could really get. He goes, "Hey, Salt Lake! What is that smell?" but of course, it's like he's acknowledging that he's in your town. So what do we all go, "Hey!" And then, of course, he did the whole thing like, "It smells like a pet cemetery." And then they went right into the song. But it was like any acknowledgement that he was in, that he knew where he was sort of awesome. But that is, Salt Lake is a really beautiful city that is very strange. The place you do have to see if you ever go to Utah, though, and everybody will tell you this, and it's one of those things that lives up to it because the hype is almost always, it almost always outstrips the reality. You got to go to like Moab or Southern Utah. It is just the most amazing thing. It is just, it is really one of the most astounding things you will ever see in your life, because you always hear that thing about how Southern Utah is what they based the landscape in the Roadrunner cartoons on, where there's just these insane, like very thin spires of rock within like a huge boulder on top, and you don't know why it's there or how. And then you go there and it's like an entire landscape just filled with things like that. And it really is like you were on an alien world of some kind. It's astounding. It's beautiful. So if you ever get a chance, you got to go there. We've been talking for like an hour about Salt Lake.
I admire how you spent about 15 minutes trashing Salt Lake, but then found something nice to say about Utah.
Well, I'm glad I lived there. Salt Lake is sort of like exercising, where you hate exercising, but you like that you have exercised once you're done.
I had the experience. I'm so glad I had that experience.
I'm glad I moved, but I'm also glad that I lived there. Because see, now I can trash it with authority too. I can just go like, hey, I can say that I'm married to a Mormon, so it's like, I can pass judgment all I like. This is actually a great way to dovetail with Portlandia, which I know that you have – and I'm like the last guy in the world who hasn't seen it apparently, because our friend Seamus he said he saw it last night. Presumably it was on the tubes somewhere and he tracked it down. So we were talking about how Portland is a place that people love, and I guess – and I haven't seen Portlandia, so I can't really – I can't really say, but there seems to be some sort of a split on A, whether the show is good or whether it's not, and if people who feel that way about it are viewing it through the prism of like, well, it's about my town, and whether it is, and whether it makes fun of Portland or whether it does it like with some sort of you know, charming, some sort of charming tough love. And I don't know about anything because I haven't seen it, but what is your take on it? A solid meh?
A very solid meh. Yeah, I saw the first one. You can find it on the interwebs. It's on Hulu. If you're on the internet at all, I think you've probably already seen the funniest bits without seeing any episodes.
I saw
that
the Dream of the 90s thing is
In the pilot, that's by far the funniest thing in the first episode. You know, it felt to me, and I like to think I have a pretty good sense of humor, like sort of a 12, 15-ish Saturday Night Live skit.
The one that goes on and on and on forever.
And it starts out with a really funny concept, but it doesn't quite follow through on execution. In the first episode, there's a skit about an adult hide-and-seek league.
And it goes on for a very long time.
And it's not as funny as you really want it to be. And I feel that way about the whole thing. And Fred Armisen, to me, there's this tightrope of smugness that he walks and occasionally falls over. I didn't think the comedy was all that mean-spirited when it came to Portland. And I thought it got certain aspects of, especially sort of hipster Portland, that culture. Asking to see the chicken's resume, essentially, when you order it, that kind of thing. I thought I got that down pretty well, but I just wasn't that funny.
If it was about Philadelphia, and you were watching it, would you even really care?
No.
Our friend Seamus says, and I've heard people say things like this. Said it was less funny than it was sort of astonishing in its accuracy. And he said it was – so his take is that it was sort of interesting or sort of like, oh, my God, that's so Portland, but not actually funny. He said, it seems to me they pretty much nailed Portland in 20 minutes. Another episode and they'll have covered everything there is in the city. I don't really know how they can fill a season with that, much less multiple seasons.
Well, they've only got 6 episodes in the first season, so keep that in mind.
It's also the kind of thing where – it's the kind of funny where you don't actually just laugh out loud.
It's smile funny.
Yeah, even the stuff that is funny. Like, you know, I've said that I really liked the first part of that thing about the people and the chicken and the farm. If they had stopped
and it just kept going
with that section. But even that though, I don't think I ever laughed out loud at it. It's just the kind of thing that you smile at and you go, "Oh, that's funny." And that's really as funny as the funny gets in it.
It's NPR funny.
Yes. Nah, it's not that smart. It's not.
It's funny in a Spalding Gray kind of way.
It's funny on a Saturday night and you're a college student and you're a little bit stoned and you're waiting for Weekend Update.
And you go, oh, that's so true. We're just like that. We love waffles.
But it's you mentioned the adult hide-and-seek league thing, which is one of those I thought it was very funny, the idea of it. And then I was watching it on Hulu, and I just started getting bored with it. So I, like, fast-forwarded a little bit, and then I went, wow, are they still on this? And I fast-forwarded, like, wow, is it still the same sketch? And then fast-forwarded a little more.
This is what I call the onion syndrome, which is where great headline, but then you realize that it's hard to sustain an entire article with anything approaching the comedic punch of the headline. And again, I'm not trying to trash the show. I haven't seen it. And, you know, getting a TV show, even on IFC, which is a niche network, is difficult. And so I admire anybody who can do that. But I mean, it's, you know, but at the same time, it's like ultimately the thing either makes you laugh or it doesn't. I mean, it's got to be funny for it to work.
Well, I'll tell you, my favorite thing about it was finding out that Carrie Brownstein can act.
Yeah, she is really good.
Yeah,
she's
I think
really
you made
funny.
The same observation that she was. And she seems to be the thing that everybody seizes on as like, you know, here's the best thing about this is her.
Yeah, that's how I felt.
Don Taylor, let's do a couple more. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We got to get the top five done. We got to do the top five classic bubblegum songs of all time. And we will do question number 3 in our EH vending contest this week. Here is Don Taylor.
23 years after she was abducted from a New York City hospital, a Georgia woman has solved her own kidnapping. Carlina White was taken from Harlem Hospital when she was 19 days old, making national headlines and baffling police for decades. Raised in Connecticut and Georgia as Nejdra Nance, White began sensing...
Please to spell?
N-E-J-D-R-A.
Okay.
White began sensing something was amiss around the time she turned 16. She's held the view for a long time that she did not belong to the family she was living with, said police spokesman Paul Brown. After finding what she believed to be a baby picture of herself on the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children website.
Oh, that's creepy. That's so creepy. Oh, my God.
White contacted her biological mother, who contacted police. A DNA match was confirmed on Tuesday. But White didn't even wait on the tests, according to the New York Times. The family reunited last Friday in the Bronx, and the daughter now plans to move back to New York.
Wait, so but what is...
She's 23 years old.
Right.
And since she was 16, she's gone,
Wait, but what about... So who raised her, though?
Apparently these people who kidnapped her from a hospital when she was 19 days old.
But they've been arrested and whatever? It doesn't...
I believe so, yes.
Okay, so that was my thing, is like the chain of it. Was she still... So she wasn't still living at home with them when she unraveled all this?
No.
Okay, because that was my whole thing. Is like, well, you know, she sees her picture somewhere, which is so freaking creepy that I can't even express how creepy it is. And then her first call was what? What was the first thing she did?
Well, I said that since she was 16, she's believed that she didn't really belong with the family.
But once she found her picture.
Once she saw the picture, she contacted the police.
Okay, so she did call the police first and said, like, hey, guess what? Here's who I am. And they went and presumably rounded up mom and dad. God damn, that's
unnerving.
This is
like every angry teenager's dream, except for the part where she now has to move to the Bronx.
Totally.
Yay!
Well, you're not my real parents!
Connecticut. Oh,
well, and you know, and if you listen really, really carefully, you can hear the sound of like some Jacqueline Suzanne type over at the Lifetime channel just sort of bump, 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 just pounding out an Insta book in a hotel somewhere.
Valerie Bertinelli is the kidnapper.
Exactly.
Contact her for the rights right now!
Yes. The I actually saw at one point there was a great sort of like a little, it was a sort of create your own made for Lifetime movie Mad Libs game. And they all sort of revolved around things like this, where you sense that everything that is made. And is it still called Lifetime?
The channel? Yeah.
Yeah.
Television for Women.
See, yeah. But I wasn't quite sure if that was like if it had been renamed something else, because a lot of stuff, you know, like it gets renamed now. Like it'll be like there's that. Isn't there just like the Wii? Channel WE?
Yeah.
But that's a separate thing, right?
Is that a
separate network
thing
altogether? But it was, but they all those made for Lifetime movies, they all seem to, it's like Harlequin romances of an earlier age, or sort of the, like the pulpy kind of girls in trouble novels. They all had that formula of like the rebellion, ruin, and redemption. And Lifetime movies all seem to play on long suppressed mother issues that the viewers probably have in their own lives. Again, where it's a sort of thing of like finding out you're not my real mother after all. Yeah. And then Meredith Baxter Burney is in all of them.
Yeah, there's I think four or five just standard plots for the Lifetime movies. There's the addiction and or eating disorder stories. Uh-huh. There's the
mother's shame.
Turns out my mom is a whore, or I found out my daughter's a whore. There's the affair movies where someone falls in love, and then there's the ones where Jacqueline Smith like has to go live on a ranch and falls in love with a cowboy.
Yeah.
That's basically your entire menu for the Lifetime movies.
Apparently these are the dreams of American women. Well, right there, you've just summed it all
that's
up.
That's what we think about when we're alone.
I am fascinated by I am fascinated by the concept of ghostwriters and of fiction mills where they just churn out like especially series books like men's adventure novels where it's like, you know, Mac Bolan is the executioner and you'll see these guys reading like, you know, executioner adventure number 297. And you'll go to bookstores and there's just rows of these. And of course, women have them too. There's, you know, there's romance novels of every conceivable stripe and variety. Was it you? Did I tell you about this? I can't remember if it was. I saw this with Laura at the coast somewhere with like some little bookstore. And I can't remember if I mentioned this or not. Did you know that there is an entire series of romance novels for women based on NASCAR?
I'm not surprised.
It's just women falling in love with / running away with / having torrid affairs with. Like some guy named, like, you know, Chip McCluskey.
Actually, the Australian Army sends those to their female soldiers.
Well, and it's like you figure, as much as I know, and I mean, even I know that women probably look at that, I mean, such as yourselves, and you go, please, no, don't. But why must I be represented by this dreck, by this dribble? But that must speak to or resonate with some percentage of the female population, or just the laws of economics indicate that it would not exist.
Yeah, obviously there's money being made, or else they wouldn't have an entire series of them.
And I mean, on the one hand, it's appalling and says such horrible things about us. But also, at least people are reading.
Right. Well, that's, you know, and so it's, I guess, a bit of a mixed bag.
But there's paranormal Harlequin romances where people fall in love with ghost guys or
she's
vampires or something.
Violated by a specter of some
yeah.
kind.
Yeah. Yeah, there's whole. I mean, there are.
Well, it starts out as violation, but then it turns consensual.
Well, yeah, it turns into love.
Just like Luke and Laura.
Yes.
Zing.
I don't know if I ever told you. When back in my punk rock kid days, I was at the Whiskey A Go Go one night, and the place was just packed full of mohawk. You know, punk rockers with the safety pins, that sort of thing. And Anthony, what's his name, who played Luke,
right,
walked into the Whiskey, and this huge, burly punk rock guy looked at him from across the bar and screamed at the top of his lungs, "Luke, why'd you rape Laura?"
Did you ever see the? Did you see the whole with the reuniting episode that they did, in the mid 90s
when she came back and it turned out she wasn't really dead, and that one,
and they showed that whole thing in weird flashback and whatever,
because I was completely addicted to it during the whole Luke and Laura days,
and they completely excised the raping from all of it. There was no, they did not, because I was
the raping is a very important part of the Luke and Laura story.
That was a thing. They retconned that like nobody's business. I mean, and I was actually watching it. I had a female roommate at the time, and she was huge about General Hospital. Mm-hmm. And but Luke, do you remember when we first, and then they did the whole flashback thing, and they just completely glossed over it. Oh, and they used a combination of recreation, recollection by other people, and some stock footage, but glossing over the fact where he forces himself on her. Because I guess they must know that you could do it then, or maybe you couldn't do it then, but people don't really remember it, or they have a fuzzy memory of it. But you certainly couldn't do it again.
I want to make a horrible joke here about how the Oregonian covered Neil Goldschmidt's admitting to the relationship with the poor young woman who just died. But I think my bosses would rather I not.
Well, here's the thing: your boss, not unlike my in-laws, probably isn't listening to the program right now. So I'm just saying. Think of this is sort of like on Get Smart when they would have the cone of silence or whatever that would come down over them.
It's just a lovely affair, Luke and Laura.
I am fascinated by those fiction mills, though, because not just the readership, but I am always intrigued by the guys who are just sitting there chained to a typewriter, or some woman who is just sitting there, at a word processor, and just churning these things out. Just like I am fascinated by the people who must then draw, they must create the cover art for the bodice ripping romances where it's like an Indian chief with a buckskin knife and no shirt, and he's got a woman who who's sitting on the front porch and in her southern home, and he's there and showing her the ways of love by tearing her clothes off.
He's climbing out of his NASCAR car and his flame resistant suit is open just enough to see his chest hair.
Exactly. And that there's somebody. It's like when you go to Goodwill and you see a painting and you think, well, this is a pretty bad painting of puppies or whatever, and it sucks, and so it's here at Goodwill for $2. But then you realize, you still couldn't do it. It's like when I was in Salt Lake and there was that guy who at the store that just had nothing but sculptures of dragons playing the saxophone. Which I'm not making up, by the way. And I don't think I actually even posted that one. But it was literally, store.
And this is not a euphemism, dragons playing saxophones.
No,
right?
No, it wasn't .
Would you like to see my dragon play the saxophone?
It wasn't like evolving the hamster. No, it was literally all of these big pewter and pewter type statues. They sort of like huge role playing figures. But it was of a.
I don't remember the saxophone part of Dungeons and Dragons.
That's in Advanced Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah, that's fourth edition.
That's when you're playing the Temple of Elemental Evil. I don't know what that is, but there's this. This store.
What
and
I love is when geeks break out the geek voice. I find dinosaurs fascinating.
But it was this store, and these stores where all it is like huge survival knives, shirts with the wolves and the moon, and an eagle swooping. And sculptures.
Computer wizards holding crystals
and
crystal balls.
And dragons playing the saxophone, of course.
But there were several. There was one that was a dragon riding a motorcycle. There was one that was... I've got it right here, actually. Hold on. Hold on a second. There was a technology and science, Willa. There was one that was a dragon riding a motorcycle. There was the one that was, I swear to Christ, it was a dragon inside a crystal ball, inside a skull, being stood on by another dragon altogether. And I'm not making any of that up.
One of my in-laws is actually, I believe, the manager of a store in Long Beach, Washington, which is just jam-packed. Every square inch is filled with this stuff to the point where it's in sections so that you can go to the sections.
What you're looking for.
Yeah, if you want to find all the stuff that has frogs, there's a whole section of frogs, frog memorabilia, frog T-shirts, frog cute
but where
frog
would you,
statues.
Where would you
There's a whole dragon section.
The frog playing a saxophone while riding on the back of a dragon inside a crystal ball being held by a wizard.
I know. You'd have to make that
on top of the Starship Enterprise.
That's a call.
I'm going to show you these photographs now. So these are already, by the way, these are up at rickemerson.com. They're also at, Twitter or TwitPic and you search Rick Emerson, you'll see I did a whole thing called Utah, a photo essay, which you really ought to check out because you would find it fascinating. We haven't even talked about the Flirty Aprons store.
You would love the Flirty Aprons. The power
of radio right here. Oh, that is spectacular.
Right, okay, hold on a second. There's dragon inside crystal ball, inside skull, dragon. Dragon saxophone right there. Look at that. Yeah. Awesome.
It's like it's a little bit like it's kind of like a reptilian Clarence Clemons. That's
it's
back before he sat in the chair the entire concert.
But the thing is, like you kind of and let's see what else do we have here. Here's these are all by the way at my website. Okay, one of these animals doesn't belong. There's a cobra, a Gila monster of some kind, a huge tiger, and then a chicken.
A chicken.
Yeah.
Ferocious.
I will,
feral
by the
chickens.
Way, just show you this one more from my Utah photo essay. Let's see.
These are, everyone listening should go look at these online right now because
these are awesome.
I was skeptical, but.
This is a store.
I may have to go to Utah to smell the Great Salt Lake and buy a dragon.
This is a store at the Cottonwood Mall, which is near my my in-laws' home in Provo. This is one of these stores there, and there's two photos of this. This is the Flirty Aprons store. For seducing that handsome young Mormon.
Yes.
Okay, but the creepiest part about this is if you get closer, if you look at the package for Flirty Aprons.
Oh, it's a child.
There is in fact a 7-year-old girl. So.
Yes, Flirty Aprons for children.
She's what we call Joseph Smith size.
All
right, zing.
They're never too young to get them started knowing their place.
Wow.
If you want that whole. Dragon playing a saxophone experience here closer to home, I would suggest you visit Long Beach, Washington. Go to a store called Stormin' Normans, they have T-shirts, bumper stickers, dragons, frogs. They have a whole case in the back. There you can buy live hermit crabs.
Really?
Yes.
I haven't seen live hermit crabs for sale in quite a long time. I thought that was a thing that faded away with my childhood. No. Not unlike Mexican jumping beans.
They have them at Stormin' Normans in Long Beach.
All right, then. Let's see. Well, we should do this. Let's do the third question for our EH vending contest for this week. Then we'll take just the tiniest break. We'll come back. Let's see. We got the Taser Watch still to get to. And then we got the top five coming up. Top five classic bubblegum songs of all time in honor of the passing of Mr. Don Kirshner. All right. So here's the way we're doing it this week. Typically, we'll have five of these. I forgot the one on Tuesday because I'm not that bright. So this week we have four. Every day this week, we are presenting a question. Once Friday comes and we give you Friday's question, the first person to email the correct answers to all of the questions to snack, that is S-N-A-C-K, snack, at rickemerson.com. This week, again, it'll be four questions, typically five. But the first person to email correct answers to all four questions this week to snack at rickemerson.com once we've given out Friday's question, you will win a gift basket of delightful consumable goodness from EH Vending. Listen to... Hold on. Here's the sound of Don having some of that consumable goodness right now. Doesn't it sound tasty, kids? Lipids. Here is today's question. Today's question is... Which city had the first vending machine to dispense? I'm not making this up. Which city had the first vending machine to dispense bars of gold? This is a real thing in a real city. Which city had the first vending machine to dispense bars of gold? So that is Thursday's question. Once we do tomorrow's question, Friday, once we've given Friday's question out, the first person to respond to snack at rickemerson.com with correct answers to all of the questions from this week, you'll win a little something from, a big something full of little somethings from EH Vending. Find out more about them by going to ehvending.com. That is ehvending.com, or you can contact Josh, the owner, at 360-816-1853, or James, the sales manager, at 503-897-8204. Do you have vending machines at the Oregonian aplenty every floor, I would imagine?
Not on every floor, but we do have a nice little cafeteria where there's a wide selection of. There's the two non-healthy vending machines, and then there's the healthy organic.
What's in the healthy organic one?
Kettle chips.
Really? Is that what passes for healthy and organic?
Pellegrino. Limonata.
Okay.
You can put a, you can use a credit card on that one, though.
You know what I miss? I miss the old machine that, like, would dump out the paper cup and then go...
Oh, we have that!
And put the coffee into it. And it would have a playing card, like a hand of cards on the side of it.
We have two of those.
Really?
We have one
Is it vintage?
For carbonated beverages, and we have one for coffee.
And are these modern machines, or are these, like, old-school machines?
These, well, what do you consider modern? Is 1980 modern?
Well, I guess... No. In a newspaper sort of way?
Exactly.
Those were great. I used to go visit my mom at the hospital. She'd be working like a late shift or whatever, and I would be there for reasons that sort of elude me now. But they would have that, and it fascinated me, that it would drop the machine, and then it would, or drop the cup from the machine, and it would fill it with coffee. And then you had, like, yes, the hand, like the playing card hand, that I guess you were supposed to use to face off against your coworkers or something.
Of course, because everyone's there. It's coffee break time. Everyone's there.
Right. Now, does it have, now, this machine, what if you want cream? Does it dispense it, or do you have to add it later?
Oh, no. It dispenses cream. It dispenses sugar. You can mix, say, the coffee and the hot cocoa.
Wow. Yeah. That's amazing. Stuff. That really is fantastic. So I'm just saying, like, if you're looking around the place where you work right now and you say, my God, what a fool I've been. I've been missing out this whole time. I have nothing like that. If there is a relative paucity of these machines at your place of business, you can solve that. You just contact ehbending.com. They provide all styles of vending machines, from the traditional kind to the glorious world of tomorrow today kind, to your coffee supply, to the sort of, you know, just like the refrigerated cases with the door if you run a deli or something. And they'll deal with small businesses too. So if you've been turned away, if you've been shunned, if you've been dropped along the side of the business road by another company because they felt like you did not have enough locations, or you weren't a big enough, you didn't have a big enough budget for them, it's not going to be a problem at EH Vending. They will find something that works with you and for your budget. You can contact Josh or James. Go to ehvending.com to find out more. They, of course, are longtime listeners to this show as well. So you are you're helping your Rick Emerson brethren by doing this. That is ehvending.com, ehvending.com, or call 360-816-1853. All right, so we're going to do this. We'll come back on the other side. We'll get a few more stories. We'll talk to Anna Griffin from the Oregonian. We'll get distracted by any number of things, I would imagine. And then we will have today's top five, which is the top five bubblegum songs, top five classic bubblegum songs of all time. We mentioned earlier today that Ryan White was really correct about two releases this week. He was correct about the new Social Distortion record and the new album from the Decemberists. We played a little Social Distortion here just a few minutes ago, so we'll get the other half of that equation. This is from the new Decemberists record, The King Is Dead. This song starts off with kind of a Tom Petty Wildflowers kind of a thing, but this is called Don't Carry It All. This is a new single from the Decemberists right here on the Rick Emerson radio program. Stay there. We're back right after this.
To a turning of the season, witness to the arc towards the sun, a neighbor's blessed burden within reason becomes a burden born of all in one. And nobody, nobody knows. Let the earth fall from our shoulders. I swear to all, I'm on your watch it as it arcs towards the sun. And you must bear your neighbor's burden within reason. And your labors will be born when all is done. And nobody, nobody knows. Let the oath fall from our shoulders.
The Emerson News Network. to the Emerson News Network.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us here in the land of tomorrow. It's 503-505-6964. Don't forget to join us tomorrow when our guest will include Mr. Big Jim Willig with another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101. Tomorrow, talking about the life and work of Mr. John Stewart. That's coming up tomorrow with Jim Willig. Anna Griffin from the Oregonian is here. What is coming up in your fine newspaper, Anna Griffin?
Fail.
Yeah. I'm writing a column for Saturday about a young sort of metal musician who committed suicide last year, and how his friends have responded.
And this is in Portland, obviously. Mm-hmm. What is...
He was the bass player with Prime Minister Sinister.
I'm so old. So old and out of touch. Yeah. I asked, even knowing as I asked, that I was not going to know him or his band or whatever their, like, 12-inch they put out last year. I was going to have nothing. But this is a story of him, what led him to that point? Or?
It's about how his friends have responded. They're having a big benefit concert at the Red Room a couple weeks from now, to a year after his death, to kind of honor his memory and raise money for Oregon Partnership, which is a nonprofit that helps, that runs a suicide prevention hotline. Hmm.
It's weird. I mean, not to, I don't know, that's going to be all Johnny Buskill about it, but it's strange when things like that happen. And this is a thing, we were just talking during the break, actually, about music and technology and science and so forth. But when you get older and get a sense of perspective, you were talking about how your kids had never known a world without email. And kids who grow up now never knowing, you know, they didn't go through the transition from vinyl to cassette to CD or whatever. It is also strange when you get to be old enough and you recognize patterns in music and media and in culture that you can identify future landmark moments as they happen right then. What you just immediately reminded me of was a few years back, I guess it would have been like 2004, 2005, there was a band called the Exploding Hearts. And the Exploding Hearts, who were sort of touted as being one of the next big things, and everybody thought they were going to be one of the next bands to come out of the Northwest, and they were really good, played a sort of really loud, kind of jangly power pop, sort of a little bit of a knack, kind of a Raspberries Cheap Trick thing. And they were coming back from some show somewhere, and there was a horrible accident. I think all but one of them were killed. I think it was the drummer or the bass player that survived, but was horrifically injured, and everybody else was killed. And it was the thing where it wasn't like I was their biggest fan or whatever, but I listened to the record, and we played it on the show, and then it's like instantly they were just sort of gone. And now it's now a few years later, and you're starting to see them crop up in interviews where people will reference them or say that they had grown up listening to them, or that they were, you know, they had been influenced by seeing the Exploding Hearts 9 years ago, you know, at Satyricon or something. And so when those little bumps in the in the life road happen, and you sort of look and you realize that you're seeing a seam between two sections, it gives you a Spinal Tap, would say, too much effing perspective on things. Wow, I'm just depressed myself. Good Christ. We're here with Anna Griffin from the Oregonian. And so forth. I was going to bring back the Clown Watch music to amuse myself, but that would really have the opposite effect, I think. Hello, Don Taylor. How are you?
Hey, I'm fine. I have something that will give you a smile.
Is this going to put a wry grin of amusement on my face?
We'll put a grin of amusement on your face. Last night was the first new episode of American Idol with Jennifer Lopez and Steven Tyler as judges. And as I'd mentioned, I think last show, and then I failed with the sound club. They had one of the things they did, they had a little montage of Steven Tyler flirting with some of the cuter contestants.
As he does.
Sitting there going, Angela. And then the next girl, well, hi there, sweetheart. Oh, I like your boots. You know, and some girl going, hi, Steven. And him like, hey. And
then Daryl.
And then doing the eyebrow waggles and things like that.
And he's such a hideously unattractive man.
So grossed out right now.
He really is. He really is.
But he's like, you know, he's like some male Sandra Bernhardt where you're just like, what is up with your face?
But he is so amazingly charismatic.
Oh, yeah.
And hilarious.
Yep.
And so... it's going to be an interesting season of American Idol because
of the paternity suits that will follow.
Well, and because he's Steven Tyler.
Yeah.
And this is a very short, just little clip. But this is some guy came out and sang some country thing. And he had a really awesome country voice. And this was Steven Tyler's response.
Will hellfire save matches? F*** a duck and see what hatches.
What are we doing in the game, man?
Am I allowed to say that?
Am I not allowed to say that? He says.
That is, you know, the thing about Steven Tyler is he just clearly, and I don't think it's just because, I don't think it's just since becoming, you know, like a rock star, becoming famous or whatever, because you see interviews with him when he was really, you know, when they were just starting out, those guys, he has obviously always lived in some weird playground in his head. Like there is just something sort of wonderfully just broken about him and always has been, not unlike David Lee Roth, who just clearly is like, do you get, like, I get the feeling that if you could just look inside David Lee Roth's head at any moment, there's just like pyro going off all the time. And he's like twirling a cane, and there's like a Busby Berkeley in hell sort of a thing going on behind him. He's just going, la da 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 da, wow, you know?
Well, there seem to be three kinds of like super mega rock stars. There are the guys that just kind of, it's almost like it's a trial to be a rock star. They may have started out enjoying it, but as they got older, you look at like Keith Richards just going, I am so old. I'm so old and so tired. And some of these guys also just look sort of bitter about it, too. It's like, do I really have to answer your damn questions about my career? And then, you know, then you've got like the guys that are just kind of, they seem to go either way. Like Tommy Lee is one of those guys. Sometimes he looks like he's having a great time.
Right.
Other times, you know, he's just about to rip a guy's head off for bringing him the wrong kind of fizzy water.
It's a day-to-day sort of a thing.
And then there's the Steven Tylers and like the David Lee Roths, who even now, you just look at him and he just always seems to be having a good time.
Oh, he loves it.
My life is great. I'm Steven Tyler. How can my life not be great?
He wakes up every day, I think, and it's like they just – it's like I saw Paul Stanley interviewed one time, and they were – you know, and Paul Stanley's another one of those guys who just – Paul Stanley, by the way, and David Lee Roth are the only two rock stars I've ever seen who did this and did it well, where they would – I saw them in concert wearing shirts with their own faces on them. I saw David Lee Roth one time, and he came on stage. He's like, "Hello, Salt Lake," and he's got a picture, just his own face. And it was almost like he was wearing Will Wheaton's recursive shirt, and it was like he was going like, "Hey," and then on the shirt is a picture of his face going like, "Hey." Paul Stanley did the same thing, and he was like, he had his own face on a shirt that he was wearing, and somebody said, What is up with that? Like, why are you wearing a shirt with your own face? He's like, "Well, I saw somebody in the front row, and they were wearing it, but I make it look better, you know." Ow! You know, and it's like, you go, okay, I guess, all right. But
it's so much more appealing than these serious, I'm a rock star, thus I'm going to save the world nonsense.
Yeah. And somebody asked Paul Stanley one point, they said like, hey, if you, you know, I forget how they got onto this, but they said, you know, so like, you know, if you could come back as anybody in the next life, who would you be? And he's like, me.
As opposed to Bono, a small child in Africa.
Right, as a hermit crab, you know, and you're just like, what is going on with you? But, you know, a guy, especially in a certain era, because music is cyclical, but we go through these areas where everything is so dreadfully serious. And it's not like I don't we've talked about moping lists and moping music or whatever, and I certainly own a lot of that and whatever, and I can sulk with the best of them. But occasionally you just want a guy, like, because the thing is, like, you want to believe. So there's that thing they say in politics where the reason that people sometimes are opposed to things that will not ever affect them, like estate taxes, is because they all believe in their head they're going to be rich someday. And you want to believe that, like, if you ever make $1 million, you'll get to keep it. And that's the thing about being a rock star. Like, you want to think, like, if you struggle and become famous, it's not going to suck. Because what kind of lesson is that? Like, become a rock star. It's awful.
The other thing about Steven Tyler, too, is that there is so much misogyny among just a lot of these rock star guys. And Steven Tyler still, he's like 90 years old.
62.
I have no idea. He's 62, but he still seems genuinely randy.
Yes.
And but he also has always seems and still seems like he genuinely likes women.
Yeah, and he's
he likes women as women, not just as, you know, animated blow up dolls. There was on American Idol last night, in between all of the like, hey, Sheila, love the boots, that kind of thing. There was this little candid backstage shot that a cameraman caught that was awesome, where there was a wardrobe person or like a stagehand or something was adjusting his shirt and I think like feeding a mic up under his shirt or something like that. And he's just doing this whole, ooh, darling, yeah, touch me there. And it's like this little short, squat, middle-aged, gray-haired woman who's just like, you know, getting the mic up under his shirt, but he can't help himself.
He is in the very best way. And Steven, the other thing about it is you see him interviewed, and he's a really smart guy is the other thing. He's a very, you know, and he knows and he understands a lot about music theory and about, you know, the sort of the actual sort of I don't say the mathematical aspect of it, but almost, you know, but he understands the underpinnings of the inner workings of music and why certain things function, because his father was a pianist and was a classical musician and, you know, and taught him like the piano and the cello and whatever when he was just a kid. And so he has that. But then it's that also that thing where like when adolescence hit, like he somehow got like a triple dose of hormones or something. And he's also just like crazy. But he but Steven Tyler is one of those guys where it's like he is very childlike. I mean, in the best sense, that he just seems so giddy and just ebullient all the time. And he just, as you said, seems to be having a phenomenally fantastic time. Probably part of that also comes from, A, you know, the number of times that guy came within just a whisper of overdosing. I mean, in the 70s, you know, and by all accounts, except for he had a relapse in the late 2000s, I think, with pain medication after he was in an accident. But I mean, except for that, he's been clean and sober apparently for like 20 years, and everybody sort of says that that is the case. So he has that. Plus, you know, I mean, those guys were just so down and out and gone and forgotten. Steven Tyler was living in a $20 a week flop house at one point. This was after the rise and fall of Aerosmith. $20 a week flop house, hobbling around on a cane because he was so dope sick he couldn't stand. And he was squeezing. He'd spend his money on toothpaste and would spend his days spackling in the cracks in the wall with toothpaste because he thought that people were watching him through the walls. And I mean, that's where he was at some point. And, you know, and now, I mean, to be given, you know, to come back and be even bigger than they were before, I think that is a guy who really honestly recognizes that, like, you know, that you don't get that chance once. And he got it twice. And that he's, you know, and that he's going to enjoy however long he's here. So I saw a great interview, and then we got to do the top five here. I saw a great interview, and the Taser Watch too. I saw a great interview with him where they asked him, they said, aren't you afraid of becoming a self-parody, you know, where you're going to be like one of those guys that's like a caricature of yourself in old age? And he actually said, he goes, well, you know, he's like, I used to be worried about that. And he's like, it used to be a thing that bothered me, but you thought, well, who else is going to be a parody of me? Somebody else? No. So I'm. He said, "There's nobody else that can be a caricature of me but myself." And so, he said, "So if I'm 90 years old and I'm singing 'Walk This Way' on the roof of the space shuttle, goddamn, that means I'm still here." And it was like, whether you agree or disagree, it's like he's just so forcefully joyful about it. You kind of go, well, all right, I guess it works for you. Have at it. So would you recommend that I watch a little bit of American Idol just to see him? Is it worth it? Because I hate that show.
Well, no. If you hate the show, then I'd say no, because you have to see.
He would be the only thing I'd be watching for.
Yeah. He's so far. I mean, it's been one show so far, and it's the audition stuff. And so there have been moments that were really enjoyable, and they were all him, the really enjoyable moments. Some guy came in and was singing some blues song that Steven Tyler knew, and so he's like drumming along on the desk, and they go, yeah, you know, and just really, he's like really enjoying the people when they're good.
Right.
Beyond what he should be. He's supposed to be sitting back and judging them, and he gets so into it that it's kind of hilarious.
Probably the great thing about Steven Tyler, as opposed to Paula Abdul or anybody, is that it doesn't matter. Like, he doesn't care. I mean, it's like he does not – this is not the gig he needs to eat.
Yeah.
And it's not like Paula Abdul, who had some success but is now, you know, teetering on the brink of has-been, and it's like she got to cling on to it. Or Ellen DeGeneres, who is – not, you know, she's not at that level, but she's also not. Ellen DeGeneres is not so permanently ensconced, you know, in her career that she can afford, you know, to sort of take anything very lightly. And, you know, and I think because she's actually gone from the show, right?
Yeah,
isn't she leave?
Yeah, she didn't.
And I think she said that she could not invest enough in giving people, you know, the criticism that they sometimes needed, you know, because that is, especially because that's at odds with her daytime TV persona. And she can't screw around with that right now because she's still building the empire.
And she said she was just very, very, very uncomfortable having to like reject people and let them down and give them back.
But it's like Tyler, he just doesn't care because it's like, what is it? You know, if this gig goes away, guess what? He's still Steven Tyler.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it doesn't matter. And he can be honest because what are they going to do? Fire him? I mean, even if they did, it's like he's still more famous than anybody else associated with that show. He does not need them.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting once they actually get to the judging portion and the people are, you know, we get past the just sort of picking people and seeing the auditions and even this, you know, this is all very stage managed because they show you at the beginning of American Idol, they have stadiums full of people now,
right,
at every city that they go to. So there are teams of probably hundreds of people who already pre-screen everybody before,
right,
they get to the judges. So they're only seeing the really bad people that they think will be funny for,
sure,
TV, or the really good people that they already know are going to go,
sure,
through.
Sure, no, it's a pre-interview, yeah, where they find,
yeah,
people that are especially horrible or great in some weird. They find the William Hungs of the world. And,
yeah.
And put them out there.
Did it seem noticeably more positive?
I think
night?
I think think so. It was a little less mean-spirited. There were a lot more. I mean, this first episode, there seemed to be a lot more positive things and a lot more good stories. And, of course, they always throw in their heartwarming stories. So you have to have the heartwarming stories. The girl whose dad used to sing doo-wop with her, and then he got throat cancer, and now he's better, but she's finally old enough. Because I guess you only have to be 15 or 16 to audition.
Which raises some interesting issues for Steven Tyler flirting with the girls.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because there was one girl that he would say, oh, you're pretty. And she was 16. We got to go, Steven, no.
Not 1975.
That's illegal. Yeah. You're not allowed to do that anymore. And, you know, the girl whose parents escaped Kosovo. Oh. And came here and now and to for a better life, and now she's auditioning.
And it makes me sound awful to roll my eyes at that. It makes me sound like a terrible person, but I'm not rolling my eyes at her story. It's that you know there was a producer somewhere going, that's fantastic. Death camp, you say.
Oh,
wonderful.
These are always the people that they actually take the cameras and go home with
them. To their home.
Because there was a guy who he and his dad were living in a shelter. You know, he and his dad and his twin brother were living in a shelter.
Of course.
And now they don't anymore, but it's still paycheck to paycheck. So this could be like a great life-changing thing for them. And
you know what I wish they would do, and maybe they have created this. I wish that they would have a show. And I'm not trying to knock people who sing or who play an instrument who don't write their own stuff, whatever. And I used to be real hardcore about that. I used to be very, very judgmental of people who performed material that they did not write. I used to be very dismissive of that, and I've come around to recognize that interpretation is its own sort of art. But I do wish that there was a show, maybe with some competitive element to make it more interesting, that showcased songwriters. You know, even a thing like Storm and Paul have talked about being at those contests where they'll give you it's sort of like the 40-hour at a film festival, where they give you like a keyword and a phrase and like a style, and you get like 12 minutes to write the song. I mean, that's a thing that I would watch.
Well, the first of the two different seasons of Rockstar, I believe it was the In Excess one, the first of the two was really good. And one of the reasons it was really good is because you saw the backstage stuff.
Right.
You would see them having to like run into the room and then argue over who was going to get to do which song.
Right.
And you saw them actually listening and learning the songs and working with the band on their arrangements. And that was really interesting. And then, and of course, in both the versions of the show, eventually they would get to do at least once do something they had written themselves.
That was always the best part too, like with the Storm season when she was on there, and like Lucas Rossi and all those people, and they would each get to sing a song they wrote, and that was consistently the most entertaining portion because they were usually really good, and even if they weren't, you got a good sense of who the performers were. So
yeah, I would like to see more of that.
Part of what's American Idol, I stopped watching a couple seasons ago, and part of the reason was it had gotten so repetitive and so predictable,
right.
And so much of it was about not what kind of voice you necessarily had, not what kind of innate talent you necessarily had, but song selection.
Right, right.
And whether you picked the right song.
Yeah, and the right, and that's it, and that coupled with everybody sort of now feeling like they have to be a certain character, an archetype that they have seen before.
Oh, yeah. You have to be real. I think most reality shows, you go back and the first few seasons are far more interesting because the templates have not been set up.
They don't know what it's supposed to be.
Last season was interesting because there were a couple of people in the mix who were distinctly different than normal. And one was a woman named Crystal Bowersox. And she, had the white girl dreadlocks and a little bit heavier, not a fat girl by any means, but a little heavier than the slender waifs
right.
we usually see. And she had this very sort of country bluesy, almost Janis Joplin kind of a voice thing going on. Played her own guitar, wrote her own songs, and she was so different than the others. And she ended up actually making it all the way to the end. And I think she came in number two or something.
Well, it's like you don't
and
even.
And now she has a record deal. As
yeah, because well. I mean, being losing, but not getting, getting second or third is no longer an indication you're not going to make it. And being first. Winning doesn't even really mean anything.
Well, being second or third actually probably suggests at this point that you're going to have a better career because you're different in some way.
And because they're not going to immediately stick you in the studio with the pre-written album that they have been crafting the whole season long that you just go in and do the vocals on, which is like what happens to the Justin Guarinis and the Ruben Studdards. And
a moment like this, version 36.
Yeah. I mean, whereas if you're second or third, they already used up their pre-written material on whoever won, but you've got enough sort of heat on you that you can make a little, which is, I think, is the Kelly Clarkson. Because she was second, right? Didn't
no,
she lose?
No, she won.
Did she win?
She won, but it took her a few years to actually start doing.
To kind of find her own sort of a thing.
To move away from their production style and doing her own stuff.
I just want to know what happened to O-Town. O-Town. That's the band that I followed. It's the only music reality show that I ever just followed like every single week, to my undying shame and horror. Well, let's do this. Let's move the Taser Watch to tomorrow. Okay. But I will take a moment to talk about one of our fine business partners that helps to make this exciting program possible. We're going to do the top five here in just a second. The top five classic bubblegum songs of all time in honor of the late Don Kirshner. Squires Electric can be contacted at 503-252-1609. That's 503-252-1609. Somebody's also noting, by the way, that I did not reveal what phrase should be stricken from the English language. I'll do that right as we go into the top five here, sir or madam. You can contact them at squireselectric.com or 503-252-1609. Just as earlier, we were talking about EH Vending, and if you are a business owner or an operator, you're getting ready to launch a business, or, you know, in the case of Squires Electric, if you are moving into a new house, you're going to be remodeling, if springtime is coming around, and you're starting to, you know, even if it's just a house that already exists, but you're going to be refashioning the inside of it, or if it's just a house that was built in a time when they didn't necessarily wire for everything that you got now. You got to make sure that that's done correctly, because if for nothing else, you move all your stuff in, and then if you just, like, the first time you plug in, like, your printer or something, and the entire house just glows for a second, and then kind of goes, and then there's just a sort of, then there's just an unnerving sort of smoky smell in the air, and then you sleep real lightly for a couple of nights.
Or maybe you want to wire up some nice lighting in your wife's basement closets that are on either side of your photograph of yourself in your giant sunglasses.
Or I was going to go a different way. I was going to say, if you want to have your wiring buttressed so your many vending machines operate properly in your kitchen or in your living room, so your drunkard friends are there spending money on Funyuns all the time. I mean, this is a thing that Squires Electric can help you with, because you don't want to have to move into the house, find out the wiring is wrong, and then move all your stuff out, and then you go live in a Motel 6 next to Craig T. Nelson for a couple of weeks while they're redoing your house. You don't want that. Same thing with the business. You know, you don't have to. The city comes in, they inspect, you fail, you have to get everything redone, cost you more money, cost you more time. Have these guys come inspect it before you bring the city out there, and you're going to know that you're going to pass. Squires Electric, they are licensed, bonded, and insured electrical installers, contractors, supervisors, and they're good guys, and they're going to make sure that it's done correctly and it's done right the first time, and you're going to get an estimate up front so you know what it's going to cost you. 503-252-1609. Write it down or rue the day. 503-252-1609 or Squires Electric. .com. And by the way, it's not in a closet. It is between it's between a wardrobe and an armoire, and it's sort of a and it's on a, and it's smallish. I don't really know. I think if you put a lot of light around it, that would just look weird. Then you would look like my friend Chris in high school, who had a strange shrine to Winona Ryder in his bedroom. It was just a lot of candles and sort of things clipped out of Premiere, and it looked a little strange. And eventually, we quit going to his house. There was no point to tell that story. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. We're gonna look over there. Here's your top five.
3, 2, 1, fire.
One more thing about Chris and his shrine to Winona Ryder, actually. So you go into his bedroom, and I swear to God, he would just have, he subscribed to, like, Premiere and Entertainment Weekly and whatever, and he would just cut out all these pictures of Winona Ryder, and he would put them on the wall, and then he would have this sort of, like, weird half Christmas life, half candles sort of thing. And then in conversation, and you have to just trust me when I say that he was not creepy in the way that this makes it. Like, he wasn't Star 80 creepy. He was just sort of like, didn't quite fit in this realm of existence creepy. And he would occasionally, in conversation, just refer to her as his wife. I don't know what that was all about. But whatever became of him. He's probably under the care of the state at this point in one form or another. Moving on, here's your top five for Thursday. So Mr. Don Kirshner, the man with the golden ear, passed away a couple of days ago. So in his honor, we are counting down the top five bubblegum songs from the classic era. So we had no Archies, no Monkees on this list. And, you know, and it all is sort of a 60s, early 70s kind of a thing. These are the top five bubblegum songs from the classic era here on the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Don Taylor?
Our honorable mention is the Rock and Roll Double Bubble Trading Card Company of Philadelphia with I Love Bubblegum Music.
So this is a great song. I believe this came on the... And like so many bubblegum songs, it's such a perfectly crafted piece of music. It's great because it's a song about bubblegum music, and they name check a whole bunch of the biggest bubblegum songs of the time. And they actually name check songwriters. They'll actually say Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart coming up here in just a few.
Turn me on, Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart, wonder what she's doing. Yummy, 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 yummy.
It's not a great song, but it's sort of fantastic in its own way.
Oh, teeth hurt.
What's that?
My teeth hurt.
I own an astonishing amount of bubblegum music, actually. What I don't have, actually, I don't have any of the original Flexi discs, because these would come on the backs of, like, cereal boxes sometimes. And one of the artists, actually, that's going to be coming up later in the list, actually, the song is pulled from a Flexi disc, but it's not mine. It belonged to somebody else. So
I remember my deep abiding love of Bobby Sherman.
Yeah.
I was so excited when there was a I think it might have been like Sugar Pops or something. I'm not sure which cereal it was, but there was a special Bobby Sherman edition of the cereal that had a Bobby Sherman single, an exclusive Bobby Sherman single in Flexidix on the back of the cereal box.
It's fantastic. And I mean, it's like, and just, you know, your kid getting like some $2 thumb drive or something in a box of cereal is just not quite the same, you know? Or however they do that now. A free download. It's just not, you know, you want the thing. These are the top five classic bubblegum songs of all time. Don Taylor. And by the way, let's just acknowledge how great the name of that group is.
It is. The Rock and Roll Double Bubble Trading Card Company of Philadelphia.
And by the way, I think all of these songs are done by like the same five guys under just a bunch of different names. So,
number five, the 1910 Fruit Gum Company, Indian Giver.
I don't really know
this
that you could.
This is a great song.
You probably couldn't put this song out now with this name anyway. Joan Jett also does a fantastic cover of this. Listen to that deep, rich 1960s production.
I can still remember, it wasn't long ago. Things you used to tell me, you said I had to know. Told me that you loved me, and that you always would. Then I said I love you.
Stereotyping in 3, 2, 1.
Indian giver, Indian giver, you took your love away from me.
Wow.
Indian giver, Indian giver,
you Indian giver, you gypped me.
Great song though, and it's got that cool little like these boots are made for walking slidey guitar note thing. The one great thing, too, because these are all just studio musicians. You know, it's not like these are some kids in a garage somewhere. But these songs, a lot of them are just this side of garage rock. I mean, they have that kind of weird rawness to them where if they were just a little louder, they would almost have, you know, a kind of garage rock thing going on.
It's probably that jangly production value that comes from, you know, them writing the song and then 20 minutes later sending a bunch of studio musicians in to record it.
Who've never seen it before.
Yeah, you have half an hour, guys.
Yeah, and they're just sight reading it as they play it. These songs also have, they all have great rhythm sections. And they all have that weird, that like stacks, that that like Otis Redding style, that little, that real strong backbeat that they've got there.
Oh.
Come on, it's great. It's freaking
the
awesome.
The Hammond organ.
I could listen to this all day. I really could. All right. These are the top five classic bubblegum songs of all time. Don Taylor?
How many different ethnicities do you think we've offended in this particular show? We started with the Frito Bandito and Sambo's Restaurant at the beginning of the show.
Which, by the way, there is a... It's a long story. I don't even remember how we got... Well, I was asking about the Frito Bandito because I was... I think, which is an offshoot of the Twinkie the Kid, Hostess Pie, the Magician.
No, there's a completely different company.
I know, but I'm saying in my head, though.
Okay.
One triggered the other. I was thinking about sort of anthropomorphized mascots. And I think, by the way, they all came about because that thing at the beginning of the show with Mr. Yuck and the Yuck Mouth. And I was thinking about characters of weird... Where, like, you're like, what is Time for Timer? Is he a hunk of cheese? What is he? But then we were talking about the Frito Bandito, and I said that I was amazed that hadn't come back in some weird, edgy, ironic way, that some section of the populace hadn't embraced that and started putting it, you know, the Frito Bandito on a T-shirt as some sort of strange, like, this will upset older people sort of way. And then you said, did you ever eat at Sambo's Restaurant? And sure enough, I did. And that led to the conversation that there was one remaining in Lincoln City for quite a long time. And we've gotten conflicting reports about whether they ever rebuilt it, but I don't think they did. I think it burned down, and I think they left well enough alone there.
I was just thinking about when I'm driving along with my children in the backseat this weekend and I start humming to myself, Indian giver.
Mommy,
what's that, mommy?
Yeah.
What, mommy?
Nice. These are the top five classic bubblegum songs of all time.
Number four, the Cazenats Cats Singing Orchestral Circus, Quick Joey Small.
Really? And it's like, yeah. Okay. I was going to say, it's just another one of those. That's like the 60s when everybody had a name that was like, you know, it's like Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which I think was supposed to be a play on, like, you know, like the you know, the electric flying, you know, Moby Dog circus bonanza, you know, experience.
Well, the 1910 Fruit Gum Company actually had a lot of hits.
Yeah.
And there was, you know, and that was of that same area as, like, the Strawberry Alarm Clock and the Electric Prunes and things like that.
Yeah, so the Kazanets Cats Singing Orchestral Circus. This is a great song, by the way. And a strangely, a sort of strangely sinister storyline when you consider that it was, again, just a song created by some bubblegum factory, and Kazanets and Cats were the two songwriters behind this. This is where I think they were just officially running out of names, and they were just picking, you know, Inspected by 12. Yes. But this is about, if I remember correctly, it's about the hero of the song, Joey, has been wrongly accused of murder and is being pursued by the man. And the hounds are on his trail, and if they find him, they're going to stick him in jail and whatever. And so he's got to, like, stay on the run because he's been wrongly accused. And I do believe, by the way, that this chorus needs to be sampled at some point. Maybe reinterpolated, as they say, reperformed by somebody. But it's a really strong hook. Song. These are the top five classic bubblegum songs of all time, Don Taylor.
Number three, The Sugar Bears, You Are the One.
Okay, so this is the thing that comes off a flexi disc.
Because the Sugar Bears were a manufactured band.
Yes.
Ostensibly led by Sugar Bear. I got a feeling for you that I just can't hide any. And what eventually famous singer was intrinsically involved with the Sugar Bears for Gamerson?
Well, I always just assume it's Ron Dante, but I don't know.
Kim Carnes.
Really?
She was one of the backup singers.
She was Honey Bear?
Probably, yeah.
I think the logic was, look, the Archies don't really exist either. And these are just fur-covered Archies. Great horn section.
Flexi Dicks.
Yeah. That's awesome. You brighten up the world with everything you do. Baby, you're my morning sun. You are the one. I mean, that's just great. Ooh, baby,
you're my morning sun. I guess the lead singer was, it was songwriter Baker Knight. And he wrote a string of hits for Ricky Nelson, including Lonesome Town. And he was behind... thing. And I guess he was also in the new Christie Minstrels at
really?
One point. Yes.
That's fantastic. And you know, guys like this still exist. You know, there's the modern equivalent to a guy like this or Ron Dante, who, by the way, was all of the Archies, even the women, is a guy like Max Martin. And Max Martin is a Swedish producer-songwriter who any Backstreet Boys, NSYNC, or Britney Spears song that you know the words to is written by Max Martin. He wrote, like, literally, like 90% of the hits for those three acts, single-handedly, just sat at his keyboard and, wah, 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 baby, I did it again, done, and would just send it off. And there was this period of time where he had, I mean, it was something like 25 top 10 hits in the space of about 18 months. And he just would just sit in his studio in Sweden and just knock the things out one after the other and then produce them as well. And I mean, just, you know. So guys like this are still around. There's so much to say, but you've got to know. So there was a flexi disc. They must have put out like an actual record that you could buy at some point too. That had to have been the logical financial extension of this,
I guess.
Anna Griffin, did you listen to any of this bubblegum or bubblegum of any kind growing up?
I wasn't allowed music as a child. No. Yes.
Really? I was unsure there whether you were.
Yeah.
See, for you, it's just your background is just—it's like a wash of shadows to me. I just don't know.
A mystery.
You're like Donald Sutherland and JFK. You're just sort of, you know, just call you X. Awesome. These are the top five classic bubblegum songs of all time. Don Taylor.
Number two, Ohio Express, Chewy Chewy.
By the way, this is my favorite bubblegum song of all time. Me, I'm saying for me now. This is the best thing that's ever been recorded. again, listen to that great snap of the drums. I love this song. I have this on vinyl at home as part of a compilation which inexplicably includes Jose Feliciano. A little guitar line coming up here. A little Paul Revere and the Raiders thing almost. I mean, these songs are all essentially nursery rhymes. That's the thing. There's a great book from Feral House called Bubblegum Music is the Naked Truth, which is great because it's like a 200-page... I mean, it's a fun, entertaining book, but they also take it very seriously in terms of the construction and whether there were double entendres present in a lot of these songs, which, it's pretty obvious that there were. They interview a lot of the songwriters and studio musicians who up until that point were just anonymous. Like those guys, they were, in a strange way, they're like those guys who played on all the Motown records, you know? You don't know who played behind the Temptations.
Interestingly, the Ohio Express, also Jerry Kasanets and Jeffrey Katz.
As I said, like the same handful of guys doing all of these.
This was a brand name used by their Super K Productions. They apparently also had a band called Sir Timothy and the Royals.
I very nearly put Snoopy versus the Red Baron by the Royal Guardsmen on this list. I could listen to this song over and over all day. I will not.
It's been rumored that a young Joe Walsh was a member of Sir Timothy and the Royals.
That would not surprise me. So great. It seems like there's a Duncan Hines commercial in here somewhere, you know?
Yeah.
This is why I am not a professional songwriter, because if I can't write something like this, there's no point in trying. These are the top five classic bubblegum songs of all time, Dawn Taylor.
Number one is also Ohio Express, Yummy, Yummy, Yummy.
Dawn is singing every word to this. Now, when they get to the chorus, again, if it was just a little more unrestrained, it would be... I mean, that's pretty great. That's very nearly rockin'.
Side of this, by the way, a little interesting fact, is titled Zigzag, and it's an instrumental backing of the 1910 Fruit Gun Company's Poor Old Mr. Jensen, recorded backwards, which was apparently a common practice that Kasanets and Katz would do to discourage them having hits on both sides of their singles.
Awesome. Of course. I mean, you know, why cut your profit in half, Don? This is why I try very hard, and I fail a great amount of the time, but I try very hard not to be judgmental of music taste in others. Like, I can say that I don't care for something, but I try very hard not to look down my nose. I try very, very hard not to believe that I am better than or above any kind of music, because I listen to this, so... that's so great. That's so great. I don't even have superlative enough to describe how great it is. And the thing about these songs are, I think you're really right, Anna, when you say that they're so well crafted and well written, but the production is really ragged. Like, they're really only barely hitting the notes, like when they're doing the background vocals. It's all very sort of raw, and I think it's because they were just like, get it done, you know?
Well, for one of the songs, like the Sugar Bears, someone, I was looking up some information on them, and somebody commented that, like, Kim Carnes wrote one of their hits and was one of the backup singers, and that it was like Kim Carnes and this guy, and they would go into the studio with a bunch of, they said, B-list studio musicians, you know, because the A-listers were busy doing the Banana Splits songs.
I am such a failure. I should have put the Banana Splits on here.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, and not just the Tra-La-La song. The Banana Splits and their follow-up hit, I Enjoy Being a Boy in Love with You. Have you ever heard I Enjoy Being a Boy?
Oh, I was quite a devotee of the Banana Splits.
Oh, my God. It's so great. And you, Anna, have you ever heard the Banana Splits?
They're not that I remember.
It's so great. Next time you hear, I'll play it for you because it is so clearly. You know what I love is when you get a room and it's obviously just a room full of just stiffs. Just, you know, just some lame white guys sitting in a room around a table and they're trying to recreate, like in this case, a Strawberry Fields Forever sort of a vibe. For the, you know, for the Banana Splits. And it just, and it's like I live in a cucumber castle on the shores of a cranberry sea. It's so bad and so wonderful. It's just, when I was at KUFO and they would do the Rockathon every year, which is where you would, they would basically auction off chunks of airtime to listeners who could have you do anything. Like you could just do, like you could just have 3 minutes of like Court doing push-ups, or you could just play Frank Sinatra or something. And Chris Paddock and I think we kicked in. I don't even know how much money, an absurd amount of money, to make KUFO play the Banana Splits, I Enjoy Being a Boy. By the way, money well spent. I don't regret that at all.
Even as a child, watching the Banana Splits, which I loved, even I knew that it was absurd how much the actual comedy was. They were trying to make it be like the Monkees, only there were guys in big furry animal suits. And then, again, even as a child, I knew the music was terrible.
Yeah.
It was terrible.
Yeah.
But when you're like six, you're like, it's still kind of awesome.
I was going to go back to the office and work, but apparently I'm just going to go back to the office and YouTube all afternoon.
Seriously, you will be culturally rich for it.
Okay.
And when you were a kid, you were just waiting for the next episode of Danger Island. Anyway. All right. We want to thank our guest, Anna Griffin from The Oregonian. Read her in print in The Oregonian or online at OregonLive.com. A new piece coming out Saturday, yes?
Saturday's newspaper.
Saturday. Let's see. Join us tomorrow when our guest will include Mr. Big Jim Willig with another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101. Tomorrow's subject, the life and work of Mr. John Stewart. The Rick Emerson radio program comes to you live each and every weekday from high above the milkpacking district here in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk, Dawn Taylor, advanced technology and magic provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, executive producer Bruce Agler, chief of staff Cheryl Kanako, with the Rick Emerson Show, as always made possible by a generous grant from you. We have a musical interlude, followed by an encore of Legion of News, followed by an encore of this very fine radio program. Dawn Taylor's grinning insanely on the other side of the room. What have you found?
Oh, I'm going to show Anna Griffin the Banana Splits on YouTube.
Awesome. In the meantime, in between time, thank you for listening. The Rick Emerson Show made possible by a generous grant from you all, so thank you for being out there. It is Thursday, January 20th, 2011, and that is The Frequency, Kenneth. Thank you for listening. Be safe. See you tomorrow. Bye now.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
tattoos up because I'm